are we on the air?
Yes, we're on right now.
Dallas Stewardship Council is called to order, starting with Ms. Marcus. Let's get a roll of the members present. Ms. Marcus?
Marcus.
Here, any help? Eisenberg here. We're lacking a quorum, but we're going to operate as a subcommittee for the present time. Let's see, just a brief report, members. I spent, I don't know, 2 hours, 2.5 hours down in Stockton, I guess it was a week ago, with the Delta Protection Commission. You'll hear echoes of that during the presentation on the Economic Sustainability Plan, which follows later. And then I was invited down to speak to a group of legislators in San Diego, which I did this week, and they were interested in the subject as well. Okay, that is my report. Mr. Greenstaff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things to report. We included in your packet the hearing schedule, the field hearing schedule.
Right.
This is something that the council requested, and we've been able to actually secure.
That's under file item number 4, tab 4, the first item coming up.
Yes, it is. So beginning on January the 11th through January the 19th, we have a series of 5 field hearings. They all start at 6 p.m. at night and end when all of the comments have been taken.
And these are comments on the environmental impact report. That's the purpose of the hearing.
Yep. That is the purpose of the hearing. The other thing I wanted to mention was at the last meeting, you had given direction that we send a letter to the Department of Pesticide Regulation. The comment deadline for that was on Monday, I believe, mm-hmm. earlier this week. So we included a copy of the draft letter, or of the final letter,
right.
which we did send in order to meet their deadline of this week. Other than that, we're not going to have a legislative report because there's not a lot going on in the legislature at the moment, and we're not going to have a legal report, although we know that there's lots going on in the legal arena, but Chris has asked that we defer that until January, and I don't have anything else.
Well, this predates the legal stuff, but I'd commend to you the first 30 or 35 pages of the District Court of Appeals decision in the Imperial Valley quantification settlement, and it was written by Justice Roby. But apart from that, he spent, I don't know, 10 or 12 pages and incorporated language that Justice Hugo Black had written in a very early decision on the Colorado River, explaining how everybody wound up where they were, and it was understandable, powerfully written, in both by Justice Roby and of course by Justice Black, and is mostly in the first 33 of the 168 pages. Randy.
Joe, a question regarding the EIR hearings. At the last meeting, you suggested that there may be an attempt to bifurcate the meeting and deal with the EIR testimony in one part and a discussion of the fifth draft in another. Have you abandoned that idea?
No, I think we're still going to start off with a summary of the EIR, give people a chance, of the plan, and give people a chance to comment on that, and then go. But the formal purpose, then we will go into the formal public hearing portion.
Okay. Members, I should probably note on your control device on your microphone, pay attention to your microphone, you hit the white button to talk. Okay? And if the white button's on, every utterance you make, even sotto voce, is picked up. Okay?
I can hear
what you're saying. Okay. Anything else, Mr. Greenstaff?
No.
Okay. Members, let's go to file item number 5, and we note the presence of Mr. Natoli, so a quorum is present. This is the meeting summary from November 21 meeting. Are there comments or questions by members of the council? Let me just raise 2 points. Page 4 of the summary, public hearing on the draft environmental impact report. You'll recall that at this meeting, which was held over at the Sheridan Hotel, we opened the environmental impact report hearing. I think it was at 1 o'clock, and 6 minutes later, we recessed that hearing. But Pat, I just I believe that there were actually 2 or 3 people who spoke between 1 o'clock and 1:30 and 1:36 or whatever it was, and they did not appear to be listed. So if I were you, I would add the name and a summary as you see fit. That's number one. And then we noted here in the minutes that at 1:36, we didn't see any more speakers, but we hung around and kept the hearing open until the close of the announced time. Also on page number six, the first complete sentence up at the top of page six, the council felt that inevitably they will want to propose in the immediate and near term actions those stressors they feel have a unified government emphasis. I have no clue what a do you mean by this that we're hoping to achieve a small list? That's my recollection is something like, can we find a small list of things we ought to be attacking that could we propose become a short list for government agencies? Could I make a suggestion that we, unless there are other questions, that we approve the minutes with the two noted changes, allowing Pat and Chris to go back and clear up that sentence on the top of page six? It's just not understandable to me. Okay. All right, Don.
I would concur with you that, you know, what we felt. I mean, you're trying to capture maybe some comments, but I think that, Felicia said, that's a good catch. That needs to be.
Okay, other members' comments or questions on the minutes? Ms. Gray has joined us. Mr. Johnston has joined us. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak on the minutes of the last meeting? Anyone like to speak? Seeing no one, is there a motion?
So moved with the modifications as outlined.
Moved as with the modifications previously noted by Mr. Natoli. Second, Ms. Marcus. Starting with Mr. Johnston, let's call the roll on the minutes.
Johnston, aye.
Gray, aye.
Marcus, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Eisenberg, aye.
Natoli, aye.
Okay, you have got it. 6-0. Oh, I forgot to make one motion. Mr. Nordhoff is sick with the flu and in bed, and he sounded terrible when he checked in with us a day ago. So he sends his regrets. All right. File item number six, Dr. Dom.
Thank you, Chair. I'm trying to transition. I picked up my last final yesterday and jumped on an airplane last night and flew out here and have this lovely stack of materials that the staff provided me, which I will admit I have not yet all read. But I do have a few agenda items that I hope will be of interest to you. First of all, the final I picked up was for my ecosystem studies class. I had four questions. I was thinking I should have brought the final along and given it to the council because the topics are very much things that you've been hearing about from me. The four questions I asked are about the effects of forest dieback and forest fire on the hydrologic cycle of the western United States. I had a question on coastal eutrophication and nutrient loading to our coastal waters. I had a question on flow modification and its effect on fish. And I had a question on desertification and converting a lot of our former grasslands to deserts. No, you get to answer all four of them. Anyway, I have them here in a packet, and if the council meeting is not riveting, I might turn to grading sometime during the Okay. Anyway, I do want to announce one other thing is that this happened since your last council meeting is that there is a second Dr. Dom in our family. My older daughter defended her doctoral thesis on December the 2nd in civil and environmental engineering at Colorado School of Mines. She's an expert on desalinization, and she did very well, and we're very proud of her. So that's a little personal side there.
Good for you, good for her.
Share with you. I have, there's going to be two presentations that follow mine that I just want to alert you to. Jeff Mount will give you an update on the December 1st and 2nd Delta Independent Science Board meeting and give you an overview of what they accomplished. They basically had discussions with elected officials, with stakeholders, and with agency heads to talk about their review process of reviewing the science activities that go on within the Delta. And so you'll hear from Jeff on that. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that after Jeff, you'll have a report on the review panel's report on the economic sustainability plan. And Bob Gilbert from the University of Texas will be giving that report to you. So I just wanted to let you know that those are forthcoming. In addition to the economic sustainability plan, we've also had two additional reviews that have gone on since your last meeting. One of them is a review of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan effect analysis, and that That report is now posted on our website, and it is in my reading material. I can't give you a whole lot of details about it, but I do know we've gotten some responses already on the plan, and I know they have about a dozen recommendations that they led off with in their report. The other review that is going to probably be posted today or tomorrow is a review on the 2011 operations criteria and plan, basically the OCAP, and how they basically operated the water supply system.
Any preview of coming attractions on that one?
I know that the lead author of it is Ron Knibe, and that the chair of the panel is Jim Anderson. I talked briefly with Ron Knibe. I believe that the reason it is not yet posted is we're waiting for a response from the Fish and Wildlife Service and NIMS to respond to the panel's review, and once we get that, we'll post. I think beyond that, I really don't have much more to say, but we will probably be posting later today or tomorrow.
Okay.
There's going to get their response back to us, I think, sometime today. So anyway, three review panels, and two of those reports are out. One you'll hear more about shortly, and another one should get posted in the next day or two. And then the second item I wanted to bring to your attention is last time I gave you a little overview of the La Nina conditions that had developed in the Pacific, and of course I told you that it was going to be wet in Northern California, and who knows, in Central California, and dry in Southern California, and of course so far it's been exactly the opposite. Haven't done too well. The reason for that is there's been a pretty strong blocking high off of Northern California that's kept basically Southern Washington, Oregon, and Central and Northern California very, very dry for the last few weeks, and actually routed a lot of those storms to the south. And in New Mexico, where I just came from, we actually already have the second wettest December on record for at least the last 30 years that we have records for from our research project out in central New Mexico. So it is routing some of those storms south. That high appears to be starting to break down. So I suspect we'll get into the more normal pattern, which is dry in the southern part of the California and wet in the northern part, which is predicted to continue through it, through the winter into early spring is the latest predictions for the La Nina. Temperatures are about a degree Fahrenheit colder than normal in the central and eastern Pacific than you would expect at this time of year, and that's what's driving some of the atmospheric anomalies we're seeing. So just wanted to give you a quick update on that. By the way, just the other thing is, if you look at the website that's there, they have two very distinct bullseyes where they're predicting very reduced precipitation this winter. Those two bullseyes are Texas and South Florida. Not good news for Texas, which is already in a pretty severe drought. And then the two other agenda items that I wanted to briefly bring to your attention. The first one is on the November 2011 fall midwater trawl fish abundant indices. This is information that was relayed to me that came from the Department of Fish and Game. Anka Mueller-Solger is the one who actually routed this to me. Anka, I think, would be your primary source of information within the council staff, and then certainly DFG if you want to get some more details. But I just wanted to highlight that the trawl data that's come in from November continues to have some upticks and some good news. Basically, the September through November indice for Delta smelt is at the highest since 2003, and that the indices for young striped bass, longfin smelt, American shad are at the highest they've been since 2006. So we do see some positive movement. We'll see whether that's sustained this coming year, but just wanted to let you know that those indices are being updated, and there is some information there and an attachment.
I thought the indice chart was very helpful because it gives us longitudinal information back to, what, 1968, I guess, mm-hmm. for the four species. And normally what happens is you see a report from year to year or every 3 years, and you fail to understand the context in which all this has occurred. But, Doctor, maybe you can tell me, and I've just always been puzzled, why are young striped bass referred to as age zero bass?
Basically, they haven't had their first birthday yet.
Ah, okay.
So they're less than 12 months old.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a fisheries kind of way of reporting young, basically juvenile fish.
Okay. All right. Any questions of Dr. Dom on
that? And there's one other agenda item, then we can ask, go to questions.
Randy, on this.
Go ahead.
On the fish studies, we generally associate wet years with abundance of returning salmon 3 to 4 years later. 3 to 4 years ago were both dry years.
The salmon returns have been reasonably strong this year. The one thing that I can tell you is that we've had stronger than normal coastal upwelling conditions over the last 3 or 4 years. So the indice, basically the North Pacific Gyre Oscillation, has been in a condition where they've had good upwelling conditions off the coast of Oregon and Northern California, and I suspect some of those numbers are probably related to the good ocean condition. Others who are more knowledgeable on anadromous fish can probably fill in more of the details, but at least that part of the puzzle I know has been quite good.
Okay. Further questions, Dr. Dom, on this point? All right.
And then the one last thing, this is from Sam Herriter of our staff. He asked me to bring this to your attention, and that is that the State Water Resources Control Board is moving in a process towards developing a nutrient policy for inland surface waters in California. They're looking at a couple different methods for coming up with these nutrient criteria. They're listed there. These are two methods that have been developed that are independent of each other, that are ways of setting nutrient standards. This is a process that's going to continue over the next, certainly the next few years, but just want to let you know that since nutrients are certainly a topic that you hear about and discuss a lot, that there is a movement within the State Water Resources Control Board to develop nutrient standards for basically inland waters and also some of the coastal waters of California. So. And Sam Herriter, again, is a very good point of contact if you want additional information.
Okay.
He came in and gave me reports on the two different methods that are being developed, and I haven't had a chance to look at them, but they're based on two different methodologies to come up with criteria for setting nutrient criteria for various water bodies. Some focus more on running waters, and others more focused on things like lakes or bays or coastal areas.
Okay. Any questions of Cliff on this? Okay. Dr. Dom, thank you very much. Members, if you would now go to file item number 7, Dr. Mount's with us to give this report. And if you haven't read his latest post on what the Hula Valley, I guess it is, in Israel, it's worth a good, nice short article, but very interesting.
Good morning, Dick Norgaard could not make it, so and Mike Healy is somewhere in British Columbia, so I am. Sorry, what?
Make sure your mic is on.
It is on. It's maybe I'm not close enough to it.
Okay. Yeah.
It might be a blessing. Who knows?
You've got to be on your toes here, because unless you're entertaining, he's going to be grading papers.
I see.
Now, what I almost interjected when he said you were speaking was then he's sure not to get to his papers.
It's the end of the quarter for me, too. I'm hopeful that Cliff will start grading papers. I know where he lives. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Dick did not get a chance to update you about our October meeting, or did he? This was unclear to me as I came forward.
Joe, there was a brief comment, but I'm not
sure if he did. But in many ways, I can lump these two meetings together in terms of the categories. So now that the Independent Science Board is blissfully done with the Delta Plan, we have turned ourselves to our legislative charge, which is the review of science programs and creating the assurances that best available science is being used in decision making. So we've kind of pivoted away at this point and have spent the last two meetings in what I would call fact finding. Is probably the best way to approach it. In our October meeting, which both of these meetings, by the way, I think have been the most substantive and fruitful for the board in general, and even old timers like me learned a tremendous amount in these meetings. In our October meeting, we decided we wanted to get a scope, get a look at what the scope of science and both the science that's generated and how it's used. So we actually we contacted the various agencies that have programs that either generate and or use science, and we asked them to fill out a questionnaire that is all posted online, and you can look at it, and it's actually quite informative. And we looked at 48 different programs that basically help inform decision making in the Delta, and that is an incomplete subset of the existing programs that are going on, and they range everywhere from IEP to very, very small programs, small individual programs. And it is a statement of the obvious, to known well to you all, that all board members were impressed by the amount and breadth of science that's being generated at this time. And the way we structured our review is we broke it up into four categories. We looked at water supply, programs that are working principally in water supply, programs that are focused on ecosystem management, restoration, etc. Water quality programs. There's quite a lot of water quality programs. They rarely come before you for your attention, but the rise of the issue over nutrients has really highlighted the importance of those programs. And then the last, we lumped them together into risk reduction, and really the principal focus being there on flood management. And we actually just wanted to get at a few basic questions about how science was generated and organized. And we spent 2 days wading through all of that. Now, highlights for you. Again, everything is posted on the web. But again, it is as much a statement of the obvious when I tell you there are tremendous overlaps that exist within these science programs, redundancies that exist by virtue of the fact that, you know, Phil, as you know well, there are over 100 different agencies currently involved that either generate and or use Delta science. So you shouldn't be surprised. There should be no surprise. There's a tremendous amount of overlap between them. We also came away with the notion that there might be some issues of coordination between these various programs, and I can tell you firsthand some of the concerns that the Independent Science Board members had is over just simply what to do with all this information, this massive amount of information. It's the second part that I'm going to present to you to remind you this is probably the most studied estuary in the world, and as such, it is a tremendous amount of information is generated, and there are some weaknesses in what we do with that information. So this was useful for the board, in particular, to get it to sort of, it, both of these meetings were scoping sessions, is the best way to describe them. So we got a scary handle on the magnitude of science that we're supposed to review over the course of every 5 years, that period. But it did allow us to at least sort them neatly in the water supply, ecosystem, water quality, and risk reduction functions. And again, there were many board members who were unfamiliar with the Delta or new to the Delta, and this was incredibly useful for them. And even old-timers like me were surprised. Again, all of that is posted for you. You can look at the results of that. I think it's entertaining reading, as if you didn't have any other reading to do. And that really was the emphasis of that particular meeting. And it set up the next meeting, which in my discussions with board members, they felt it was the most important and substantive meeting they've had since the Independent Science Board was established. And this is because we heard from the three major groups about some pretty basic questions. And the basic questions we asked is science, and this with a big S, science, meeting our current needs? Now, that is the needs for decision making, that's the need for, you know, for assurances, the broad range of the things that we ask science, the things we ask Cliff to do and his program to do. And if not, and we knew the answer was going to be no, if not, why not? Why is it not meeting our current needs? Are there emerging science issues that we should be thinking about now that we're going to face in the not-so-distant future, particularly as it goes to the major decisions that have to be made about the Delta? We asked broadly how might science support be improved, and improvement comes in many forms, but the two principal ways are resourcing and organization. Now, remember, we had just had a previous meeting where we got a first look at some of the complexities of science, and this was a perfectly reasonable question. And then last but not least, what do you see as the role of the Independent Science Board, and how can we help with this legislative mandate of assurances that best available science is used in decision making. So what we did is we invited three groups to come talk to us. The first group were basically the agencies that both generate and use science in decision making, and this is NOAA Fisheries, National Marine Fisheries Service, Bureau of Reclamation, the Fish and Game, DWR, the traditional agencies you guys deal with, federal and state agencies you deal with. And we had an extensive all-morning meeting with them where we explored these questions. In the afternoon, we brought in the stakeholders, which is something the Independent Science Board had never done before, and I think was an error on our part in the past. We brought in the people who actually listened to and used the science outside of the agencies, and that was an illuminating discussion. I'm sorry you weren't there to hear it. Some things were no surprise, but there were a lot of embedded surprises within the discussion. And then the next day, we talked to our other extremely important customer for science, and that's the legislature. And so the electeds, and in this case, we had their representatives show up when we had a free-ranging discussion over how science is used by them in particular and their feelings about it. So what I wanted to do, and by the way, interrupt me at any time, I wanted to sort of summarize what we learned in the process, which is helping us in terms of scoping how we'll do the review. When we sat down with the agencies, this was agencies that have been through a rough period. All agencies have been through a rough period in the past few years, particularly this year. This year's been really hard in terms of the series of court decisions, the politics of science. And they did a marvelous self-assessment of their strengths and their weaknesses. And they basically have, I'm paraphrasing. Okay, so this is my interpretation of what they said, not the Independent Science Board's interpretation of what they said. So this is Jeff Mount saying you. They basically said we haven't kept up. We haven't kept up with science. We haven't been able to keep up with the demands of science within the Delta. Simple things like the population models that we should be having, the life cycle models that we so absolutely need for management of the Delta. We haven't done it. We haven't kept up on the science side. We haven't adapted our science programs well to changing understandings, to the evolution of new paradigms within it. But actually the interesting thing is, when challenged on this, they all still wanted us to do the same thing. Let me just give you an aside on this, because you'll face this as you go through with your Delta plan. Everybody loves the long-term data sets. They love the long-term data sets, but they can't exactly tell you why. And what I mean by that is there's data we've been collecting for years, and we don't know what we're getting out of it, but by God, we really like collecting it. But when you say to the agencies, well, if you have finite resources, which of these would you give up and which would you move to, that tends to produce a great deal of anxiety, that particular question, because people don't want to give up these long-term data sets. So the answer is we need more data, almost always. And the board drilled down on a fair amount of that. They will readily admit, as will everyone else, they haven't done a particularly good job of the integration and synthesis side that we really need at this point. And now the National Research Council argued this integration, cooperation does not equal integration. They will admit that is a major problem. They admit to needing better coordination between the agencies. IEP is an example of coordination, but itself has all kinds of complexities. And they, to an individual, would like to see fewer judges involved in science and a whole lot less combat science within the Delta. One of the major themes that came out of this, and this goes right to Cliff and his organization, which I'll wrap up at the end, was they used phrases like, we need a safe place. We need a safe place to discuss ideas and to explore concepts and to just develop notions about the science without landing in court for having those discussions. And they feel as though there is no avenue for that, with one exception, and I'll get that to the end, and that's your program, the Delta Science Program, which was the shining star of this entire discussion, by the way, for all 2 days. Stakeholder groups. Keep in mind that the way you view science depends on the prism that you are looking through at the time. So it should be of no surprise to you that there was a fairly diverse array of views because we had a diverse array of stakeholders. We had 17 people. So we had 17 people testify in front of us simultaneously, which, by the way, was a logistical stroke of genius on the part of Cliff's staff, to make sure that we didn't have them in groups, and they just sat all 17 of them with us. And it was an interesting discussion as we went around the room. As you can imagine, there was broad criticism of science with all of the stakeholder groups, some very biting criticisms, some more gentle criticisms. It was all critical that science is not meeting our current needs. The water contractors were very well represented in this panel with very interesting comments. They actually decided to have the lawyer from Paramount Farms represent most of them, and like as if this was a Senate hearing of some sort, they ceded their time to their lawyer. He gave probably the most comprehensive analysis because, of course, he had more time, It was a pretty strong condemnation of the science, particularly agency science, the way it is done today. None of this will be a surprise. All of this, by the way, will be posted on the web very shortly. It's interesting reading. But again, I would say it's not out of line to say it was characterized as a failure. Those are the words that were used within it. On the environmental side, it was a very different view that was presented. Again, as we know, the environmental interests are not monolithic in their view of the world, much less the science. But the argument was made, we have enough science. We just don't make decisions based on that science. And this theme came up again and again. That is, we've done a poor job of connecting this, the most studied estuary of the world, the science that's put together in it, to decision-making. I think that is the number one weakness that we face, and of course that we have failed utterly to use the science with adaptive management. And I think that's actually a fair criticism. I've yet to see an adaptive management program in this system. Others, not necessarily environmental group and water contractor group specifically, but others argued we really need much more transparency in our science. We need much more rigor in our science, a real push for more peer review and at all forms within the science. Others still said we need reorganization of our science. So we heard it all. So we heard it all from that 17 stakeholders group. Again, I encourage you to look at that. That's all online. This was really useful for us to hear, by the way, the Independent Science Board, because sometimes we become very insular, and we're just talking to scientists, and it's nice for us to talk to people who are not necessarily the scientists and actually use what we do. There was another theme. It was very interesting. It came up again. Trust, transparency, neutral. You heard these names again and again. And, oh, by the way, Delta Science Program kept coming up as that trusted, neutral, transparent entity within a system which is suffused with a lack of trust. The second day was very interesting. We had the elected's representatives show up. So we had representatives for Jared Huffman, Fran Pavley, Lois Wolk, and John Garamendi came to talk to us. And these will be people who are very familiar with you. It was Tina Leahy, Dennis Connor, Mindy Simmons, and Josh Franco. Wonderful discussion for the Independent Science Board in particular to see what the legislature thinks we're supposed to do. I guess the legislature doesn't read their own legislation was our conclusion at the end of this, because there was such a gap between what they thought we should be doing and what we thought we were supposed to do. What we heard from them was a very interesting, you guys have to define your own role, which we're very uncomfortable with, by the way. But you guys have to define your own role and what it's going to be. It was very good. And then you guys need to help translate to the legislation, to legislators, what the science means. And actually, legislation doesn't really say we're supposed to do that. But, you know, Phil, you and I have talked about this in the past. It's unclear what the Independent Science Board is supposed to do. At the end of the day, here are the common themes, which is going to guide the Independent Science Board as they go forward with their reviews. First, we do need to improve the science in the Delta. So how do we do it? I mean, this is a huge challenge. So better science involves better organization, better funding, stability of funding, better staffing. This came up again and again, by the way, that the technical capacity of the agencies has just dissipated so much that today we rely principally on consultants for most of our work. The Independent Science Board will probably have comment on this issue in the near future. We need to improve our communication. We need to improve our synthesis. We need to improve how we connect to decision making. Neutrality. It's extremely important we find ways to maintain neutrality in these disputes. The sides are so polarized, and there's so little trust in this point. We've got to somehow put our hands around reestablishing neutral territory, neutral turf. And that's something we're going to have to think about as an independent science board. I come back to it again. The Delta Science Program is repeatedly viewed as your most neutral body in this highly polarized system. With a highly valuable suite of functions, these came up again and again. These are things like peer review. Your best peer review organization is your Delta Science Program. They do the best job of this, and you're about to hear some peer review right after me, if I'll just shut up. I know. We'll get to that. Synthesis. Now, I think they'll be the first to tell you they don't do enough of it. Nobody does enough of it, but they do sponsor synthesis kinds of work. Research support. You have to have ways to put money into research to answer important questions that isn't entirely tied to specific agencies' agendas. Every agency has their own objectives, right? But there are broader questions which need to be answered in the Delta. Right now, the only organization doing that is your Delta Science Program. Communication, everybody's got their own little communication effort, but really this is the most trusted group for communication. And then coordination. I mean, they do that endless meeting cycle of sitting with the various agencies to try and coordinate. They can't do the integration, which the National Research Council said needs to be done, but they can at least carry out the coordination side. And then finally, the other coordinators, nobody knows what the heck the ISB is supposed to do. And this can be viewed as a constraint or an opportunity. I'm not sure. So we as a group, we're going to be spending a great deal of time wringing our hands over what it is we are supposed to do. And by the way, and one side note, I do want to tell you, the universal theme on the science side, this will be of no shock to you, flows. It's all about flows. Flows, flows, and flows. Apparently, habitat doesn't matter. It's all about flows. And that was just, I just want to mention that as an aside because I forgot to mention it earlier. So to that end, we're going to be delivering two memos to you by January. And the first memo is short, succinct, and I think really important. And its principal target is the legislature. And that is, we are going to be reviewing the Delta Science Program, but we already know one of our conclusions. And if we already know one of our conclusions, we should let you know what it is. And that is that the current funding, not necessarily the dollars, but the mechanism of funding, which is relying on general obligation bonds, is inadequate. And indeed threatens the very things that every single group that came toward us wanted. The neutrality, the synthesis, the trust, all those things are threatened by the current funding structure that you have, well, not you, but we have for the Delta Science Program. I think we argue you need to strengthen that program, not weaken that program. You need to create stability in that program. It is right now the only part that I can say is trusted by all the parties. And if that's the case, you better make some investments in there. So we are targeting the legislature with a very strong memo that says you need to deal with this. This is extremely important. You too need to deal with it. But again, our primary audience is the legislature. The second memo we're sending you is a much lengthier memo and is currently being worked on by Dick Norgaard with Vince Resch helping him, and I haven't seen a draft of it, but it is to more broadly define what we see as the role of the Independent Science Board, because apparently the legislation is so nonspecific about it, we've decided to go ahead and take a crack at it. So we will be doing that. You'll be getting that in January. In our January meeting, we're going to do a couple of things. We'll deal with that memo. We will begin the process of looking at how we're going to review our first program. This is extremely important that we do a good template for review, and it's going to be the Delta Science Program. That's the first program we're going to review. We are going to start to gear up for our analysis, and I'm looking at Joe, on BDCP EIR, which elements of it are out. We're going to be looking to you on the science program for a lot of guidance on how we do that. And we're also going to be deciding what we're doing after we're done with the Delta Science program and its review. Currently, some discussions that we're having is how we engage on the single most important issue, flows. And right now, that's undecided. I want to make perfectly clear that that was a free-ranging discussion, and we're looking to Joe and Cliff or his successor for some guidance on how we'll do that. And with that, that covers what we did.
Okay, let's get some questions. I think Randy had a question. Felicia, did you?
No, just praise, but, it might hurt his feelings to be praised.
Could you use your mic? Press the button.
I'm muttering.
You're muttering. Okay. Randy.
Yeah, Jeff, you've given us a lot to think about. I was thinking in your earlier comments when you talked about overlap, duplication, in terms of the agency's activities, can you amplify that a little bit? Because in terms of funding, I've been wondering if, I've been more than wondering. I'm pretty convinced that we've reached a point in time where we need to audit everything that's going on, the entire universe of activities in the Delta. And I suspect that we'll find that there is an overlap of funding and exercises that if we're streamlined, could free up some money to place in other areas. Did the work that you conducted in these 2 days expose anything like that, or do you have any thoughts about that?
So I would encourage you to look at the programs that we have questionnaires for, and I think it's 48. I may be wrong on that, but it's somewhere in the ballpark of 50 different programs, and you will find, there's no doubt about it, there's plenty of overlap in these programs. And the reason is each agency has their specific mandate that they have to fulfill. I mean, their legislative mandate. So they have no choice. Even with our most elaborate cooperative program, IEP, we still have the data collection and some analysis and data storage within IEP, and that's being done at other agencies as well. And so I think, Randy, your instincts are correct. I can't give you the full expanse of these overlaps because it's wickedly complicated, as you discovered when you were writing the Delta Plan in particular, how complicated it really is. But I can say with absolute assurance there's abundant overlap and there are abundant inefficiencies within the system. It's easy to say, but it's much more difficult to figure out how you might reorganize that. But that was a question we asked of everybody. And by the way, the people who would be most likely to be reorganized are those most resistant to the notion of reorganization. And that should be no surprise to you. But again, as we as a board saw, particularly on the water quality side and water quality management issues and ecosystem management issues, there's a great deal of overlap between the various agencies. So again, I can't, I can go and give you a long list of specifics, but I couldn't give you the details at this point. All I know is we came away with the impression, boy, it'd be a good idea to have a very large audit and figure these things out. But what would you do with that audit? That's a different question for you to answer.
Okay, other comments, questions? Felicia.
Thanks, Jeff. That was great, as always. Really good and helpful. Now I want to go read everything you said to go read, which is good because there I have a lot of things to read.
Yeah.
And so you made me want to read yours. It's really good. The other thing, just to add on to what Randy just asked in the discussion, is that I'm delighted that you looked at that because I do think that's the kind of thing we need to be looking at in the governance chapter of the report to see how much of this we can do before we close on the report this spring, and I hope considerably more than we've done to date, and then also set in motion recommendations for what more needs to be done, because the structure of how we deal with the Delta, as fragmented as it is a huge problem for making progress on the Delta. I mean, there are certain interests that always like to have that kind of undercover of night work the system sort of thing, or they just like to do what they like to do without being bothered with collaboration with what those other guys are doing, and And it's true in every organization imaginable, the one I'm in, all the ones I've ever been a part of. But from a governmental standpoint, I think it behooves us as taxpayers and people who are concerned about taxpayers to really focus in on this. So I'm just delighted that you've already done the preliminary work on it in this context and gotten the ball rolling, because I think that'll make our jobs a lot easier in the short run. So thanks for that.
Good. Okay. Jeff, I want to congratulate you too. I think it's a really impressive effort. A couple of questions. There'll be two letters coming, could be more, but you know about two. Approximate time frame, and I understand this is not a promise, but approximate.
So we will have one of them's done in draft form and is ready for circulation to be. Because of our restrictions, we can't distribute it to the members for comment and feedback. We have to wait until our January meeting to distribute it to them for editing, final editing, and approval. So you will have it at our January meeting. Same, I think, for the larger definition of. See, the second letter we left a little unclear on it, and so we're having Dick Norgaard and Vince Resch basically draft a concept for us about what the Independent Science Board's relationship is going to be with everybody else. Then we will chew through that on our January meeting, and you will have a final. So you'll have finals of both of those letters from us in our January meeting.
A couple of things just jumped out in your report to me that I suspect will start to surface in the first letter or first memo, but will be clear in the second. The phrase synthesis covers a lot of territory, but fundamentally it's something that Dr. Mueller-Solger has talked to us about a bunch of times at meetings, and she and I have talked about it privately too. It's the notion that a tremendous amount of data being collected, but no one is sitting down trying to bring together the data from different sources to put it in an understandable format and to make observations and hopefully conclusions that you can draw from the disparate information sources. And synthesis may not be the right word, but it seems to me to be a pretty good starting word to describe something that is desperately needed, which is, even for this current unwieldy system we've got, somebody bringing together that information. Now, whether it's the Independent Science Board or the Delta Science Program or some other construct, I'm kind of agnostic, but it just seems to me that would be a very valuable thing.
To answer that, Phil, the Independent Science Board will probably say, I'm speaking for myself, but knowing my colleagues, that they're probably not the right vehicle for that. They are the right vehicle for reviewing it, perhaps, but not necessarily doing the actual synthesis itself. The number of people, by the way, at this last meeting who wanted us to do that, we would look at them and then ask them, have you read the legislation, what we're supposed to do? We don't do that. But Cliff's group does. And they did, and you all remember several years ago the State of Bay Delta Science synthesis that Mike Healy was the lead
2008
author.
Publication.
Yes. Yeah. And that kind of synthesis is incredibly valuable to the overall enterprise of science.
Whatever recommendations you give will be helpful. But if you also have a way of explaining what synthesis means in your view, that would be helpful. I mean, it has implications for the funding of research. I mean, and we traditionally, I think this is correct, just tell me if I'm not correct, we tend to authorize individual research projects, but not always across agencies for common purposes or to answer common questions. And I don't know what an approach would be that might lead to a more useful collection of data and evaluation for the council, for the legislature, but I do know that some of the stuff that Cliff and the science program have been doing seem to me to cut it in that direction. So if you have further illustrations or examples that we can use to build on in the Delta plan and supplemental documents, that would be helpful. And then number two, you didn't mention it, but I've been increasingly drawn to the potential increased utility of the estuary electronic journal that, you know, as you know, we finance in UCD and the UC system, I guess, are the cooperating agencies. And it is a what did we get, 5 issues this year? Was it 5? I don't frankly remember, but it...
4. I think it was 4.
Was it 4?
3 or 4.
Anyway, there was some we accelerated the frequency of issues and have gotten some really very impressive publications. Because that's an existing tool, if there are things the Science Board would say about how to use our existing tools in a way that might be helpful, we'd very much like to hear that.
So you're going to get that.
Okay.
You're going to get all of that from us because the first program we're going to review is the Delta Science program. And I will tell you that the journal is almost certainly to be highlighted by the Independent Science Board as an absolutely necessary for our peer-reviewed communication tool.
The thing that appeals to me, of course, and as a non-scientist, is the scientific information peer-reviewed turns around faster than would otherwise be the case, and therefore the information is coming in more rapidly. But then the last thing that caught your comment is this observation, agency observation, I think you said, the safe place to discuss ideas. That really is very interesting, and to the extent your memo can amplify that discussion, it would be helpful.
And by the way, there was some view on the part of some of the stakeholders that such a place should not exist, and that is that in keeping with transparency, the agencies, all their discussions, everything should be transparent, so that we all see it. I don't know how the rest of the, I don't know how the Independent Science Board would feel about that particular statement, but this issue is extremely important, and I will tell you that it kept coming back to the Delta Science Program as that place, their workshops, their various meetings that they do, the discussions that they have, they really like it. So there's some value in all of that, and the ability to be able to have a conversation in which you explore. Let me tell you what, from a point of view of a scientist, one of the big problems we have with too much transparency. Now this is heresy to some. Scientists don't think in linear fashion. They throw out ideas. And they throw out ideas, and then their ideas are beat by the other scientists to a pulp, and then they withdraw that idea. But in this highly polarized climate, when someone puts an idea out, it's on a website in 30 minutes, and you're being excoriated for this crazy idea, or you get to visit a judge in the process.
Or being praised for the brilliance of your observation.
Yes, depending on the idea, right. And off it goes. And I think it's dangerous. We have to be careful. Science doesn't work that way. You need to be able to have places you can explore ideas. Now, I will tell you, one of the great places this happens is the fall meetings, the estuary meeting or the CalFed meeting, because this is where scientists stand around and yell at each other in corners and explore ideas or put things up in an abstract form. But even that is dangerous because people will take graphs. You may hear about that in a bit. We'll take graphs that were put up in a forum in some place and extract data from that graph, even though that was preliminary and hadn't been peer-reviewed, and next thing you know, it's often being used in some fashion. So we need a safe place. And right now, the meetings are the safe place. The workshops that are put on by the Delta Science Program are safe. And then, you know, who knows what else. But that is something for us as an Independent Science Board to really give consideration to. Okay.
Gloria.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you also for the report. My colleagues have already shared some of the observations or comments that you made, but I wanted to ask you about the second letter that will define what the Independent Science Board does, which is kind of amazing that a lot of folks don't know what you do out there. Who would this letter be going to? Is it kind of general public or everybody?
It'll be addressed to you. Specifically, I think you will be the primary recipient of this, and it'll be essentially reporting to you how we want to function and what we view our role as. The legislation, you know, now that we had the very people who wrote the legislation were in the room, it really leaves it pretty wide open. So we're going to go ahead and try to do that. Now, I can imagine that we present that to you, and there is some pushback from you that we would like you to think differently about that. But, you know, at some point we need to define what it is we're doing
And the letter to the legislators will be, legislature will be about funding?
Yes, it will. It will focus on the fact that we think that the current funding for the Delta Science Program is structured poorly.
Do you think that letter should include definition, what the role is, some things that came out of the meeting, and duplication, the need for coordination, some of those issues that came out of the
meeting? No, thank you. We discussed that, and we felt that. And in fact, we were advised by the elected's representatives to keep it very narrowly focused, very short, and specific. And that narrow focus is on the way we currently fund the Delta Science Program. Forget the Independent Science Board. I mean, again, this is just the Delta Science Program that we're focused on.
Okay. Thank you.
Term.
Randy. Jeff, you parenthetically at the end of your report said something about, and they emphasized flow.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that in the middle of my report. Sorry.
Clarify who said that and
everybody.
And what?
What was interesting, it was the science of flows. It just kept coming up again and again and again and again. And indeed, we heard the dreaded phrase on the second day, how much water do the fish need? Which, as a board, we hate that phrase because enough is the answer, but we hate it because it oversimplifies a very complicated issue. But that's really what the hang-up is, or at least the most important science issue that kept coming to the fore. Now, there were some who did say we need to find this magic relationship between habitat and flow, that trade-off that occur between habitat and flow. But again and again and again, the issue of flow was of the science issue that was most important that floated to the surface.
Would you care to characterize what each of the three groups said about flow? Because I suspect that they were different comments.
On the agency side, better science to help on the flow management side. That came up a couple of times. On the stakeholder side, as you can imagine, there were many, many different views on the nature of flow. They gave very few specifics, now that I think about it. And by my recollection is they didn't spend a lot of time we need this specific information about flow. We just need better science for flow management and the decisions we have to make about flow management. And then the electeds were very clear, we want to know how much water the fish need. You know, that was, yeah. So, again, we didn't give them enough time to get into the gory details, by the way, just to make sure, by design.
My experience is if you had given them unlimited time, you would still be reporting the divergence of views.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That could be wrong.
Yeah.
That could be wrong.
Probably not.
Felicia.
On that, another thing, the thing that's been interesting to me in the flow dialogue is how much water the fish need is if it's just one number that could mm-hmm. be delivered whenever, you know, by truck at one moment, and that would be enough. And one of the things I think that this process, and particularly Dr. Dom's good tutelage, has sort of highlighted is the complexity of it, but that the fish need certain flows in certain places at certain times. And did any of the stakeholders acknowledge that? Because it doesn't, we're not hearing that from the stakeholders as much as we should, because there are answers, or at least progress one can make in this arena by talking about flow in that space-time continuum sort of dimension integrated with habitat and stressor reduction, where you can see a solution or at least progress happening that doesn't require the ultimate answer to that amorphous big question.
I think it'd be disingenuous of me to say that they just want that number, with the exception of the electeds. They do want that number. They want that sort of crisp answer, and which they will never get. Now, of the stakeholder groups and the agency groups, to an individual, they all appreciate how complex this is, the space and time question, and the other big question, what role do changes in the physical template of the delta, for example, or changes upstream play in either amplifying or reducing the effects of changes in flow. I think all of them get that. I really, really do. And so, but again, we're trying to simplify these arguments, at least in the political arena, trying to simplify them. But I think they all get it.
Okay.
Can I escape now?
Yes, sir, you may.
I thank you for your
time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Okay, members, let's turn to file item number 8, please. File item number 8, Dr. Gilbert is going to be presenting on behalf of the scientific panel assembled to critique the draft economic sustainability plan. And Mr. Machado and Mr. Michael, why don't you come up here? And I let's see.
And Mr. Chair, we've asked Dan Ray to come up because
right.
we received a late letter from
members. As you recall, Mr. Ray is the chief deputy executive officer of the commission and has been with us for approximately 2.5 weeks, I think it is now. And Joe stuck him with the responsibility of orchestrating this presentation. And so, Mr. Ray, why don't you tell us what's going to happen, and is this an exchange by the panel, or are we going to do presentations and then have our questions?
Well,
and congratulations, this is your first presentation to the council as an employee of the council.
And that's true. And so, because it's my first presentation, you've anticipated that I'm going to be doing things that I'm not. So I think my understanding is we're here from Dr. Gilbert, and then we'll have a conversation about the reactions from the DPC staff and consultants about their response to the ISB's peer review, or to the peer review that was done by the science program. And then I was going to make sure you were aware of the resources agencies and the other cabinet secretaries concerned.
Yeah,
about
we had on our desk this morning a copy of a letter sent to the Delta Protection Commission from the various state agencies providing their comment. I think it's a 4 or 6 page letter. That copy is available, and I assume Dr. Gilbert, you've seen a copy of that, and Mr. Michael and Mr. Machado, you've gotten your copy also. Are there extra copies, Ms. Gilbert, for the audience on that letter? Where are they available? Okay, in the back of the room for any of you who did not pick, or outside, for any of you who did not pick up that letter, they're available outside the meeting room.
Mr. Chair, the letter was dated yesterday, so it's just recently been.
Oh, I understand.
No, I
understand.
Yeah.
I didn't see it till this morning.
Yeah, neither did I.
In any event, my suggestion is going to be we'll let Dr. Gilbert give the presentation. I know you've got a PowerPoint slide presentation as well. Go through that, then have council members and staff ask questions that occur at that point. Then we'll turn it over to Mr. Machado and Mr. Michael for their preliminary reaction, and somehow we'll get through this in the next hour. Okay? Dr. Gilbert.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the opportunity to
contribute. Thank you for agreeing to serve on the panel to begin with. We do a lot of panels like this, but it is not easy for busy professionals to do, and we appreciate your doing it.
Well, it's our pleasure, and it's important, and the work you're doing is important. The panelists, there were 5 of us. 3 of them are economics experts. Rich Adams is an emeritus professor from Oregon State University, and his expertise is agricultural economics. Janie Chermak is at the University of New Mexico. She's a microeconomist whose expertise is in resource economics. And Tom Harris is at the University of Nevada, Reno, and his expertise is agricultural economics. 2 of us on the panel are engineers who do quite a bit of work with levees and with flood protection. Bill Markusen is a retired engineer with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and has worked on levees and dams for a career that spans 40-something years. And I am a professor at the University of Texas at Austin and have done quite a bit of work with looking at risk analysis and looking at decision making with respect to issues like flood protection. The panelists, we've all worked in this area before. 3 of us were on the review panel for the DREAMS effort, and Rich Adams used to go fishing in the Delta with his grandfather. So what we're going to do is, first of all, talk about the strengths of the draft economic sustainability plan that we've reviewed. The first strength is that it documents and clearly describes the intrinsic value of the Delta and its economy. And we think this is a very important contribution because it documents the public good services that the Delta provides, the infrastructure, the energy, the agriculture that then goes outside the Delta and gets used for dairy farming. This area is in the center of a mega economic region, and it really plays a central role in that region and the importance of that region. And this report clearly documents that. The second strength is that it provides valuable baseline information about the Delta economy, and the real value here is that it gets down into the weeds, into the details of the economy. The work in this was done in consultation with local experts at the University of California Extension, and it's taking information not just about California, but taking information and getting it down to the specific level of detail that's required to understand what's happening within the Delta. The next strength is that this work provides input for doing benefit cost analysis in terms of making decisions about what resources would make sense and what alternatives would be the best in improving the water supply reliability and in maintaining and enhancing the ecosystem. As an example, this table shows some of the work that was done putting together a model, a complicated economic model that will allow them to predict if things like salinity change, what the impact would be on the agriculture, not only the types of agricultural products, but also the economic value. And so that's a valuable contribution of this work. Another strength is that it offers creative ideas for strengthening the Delta economy, such as through agro-tourism. This is an example of an idea that's presented in this report for the Walnut Grove area of a way in which you could bring in additional value to the economy by focusing on tourism. Another strength is that it substantiates the value and the importance of all of the levees within the Delta. It's a system, and it's not just agriculture. There are other facilities and other important assets distributed throughout this system. So any decisions that need to be made really need to be made looking at it holistically and not looking at it island by island. And the last strength is that it provides a potentially viable alternative for improving the reliability of levees within the Delta. The idea is of a fat levee. And the basis for this is if you make a levee wide enough, essentially it can fail during an earthquake, but there's still quite a bit of soil there, and it still will be able to hold the water back. The other potential value of doing this is if you widen these levees enough, then you could provide for vegetation growing along the banks of the levees, which would not impact the quality of the levee itself. So there's a lot of potential value in doing something like this. It's generally not what we look at for levees, because usually we're concerned about property and taking up property, but in an application like this where there's quite a bit of land available, it may be possible that this would be a viable alternative to improve the seismic stability of these levees. So those are the strengths. What I'd like to do next is talk about the limitations that we've identified. The first limitation is that this is not a comprehensive benefit-cost analysis. It is an impact analysis looking specifically at the Delta. So you would not use this to then make decisions about whether, for example, an isolated conveyance is a good idea or not, because there are impacts well beyond the Delta and benefits and costs well beyond the Delta that would be considered in that type of an analysis. So one of our criticisms is that at the end of the plan, there's a series of recommendations that are made as if this is a comprehensive benefit cost analysis, and it's not, and it should not be taken beyond the context of a local impact analysis. The second limitation is that there are not unlimited resources, and so recommending that everything be enhanced or improved is not very realistic, and there's a need for you all to prioritize what's going to be the most important. Where is the biggest bang for the buck going to be achieved in enhancing the reliability of the water supply and of the ecosystem? And there's a need. I think this report has an opportunity, and the authors can take that opportunity to not only provide information on the value, but to provide some guidance on where the resources would best be spent with the greatest priority. Another limitation is that there's a definition of economic sustainability which says to maintain and enhance every key economic sector, which is not a very useful definition of sustainability because that means you can't evolve and you can't change anything for the better. So this would mean essentially you wouldn't give up a dollar of one value in order to increase the value of another sector by $10 million. It's not a realistic or useful definition of sustainability. Another limitation is that we're concerned the cost estimate of upgrading levees is potentially optimistic. There's a cost given to upgrade the levees to the public law 8499 standard of around $1 to $2 billion, and of further upgrading the levees throughout the system to be more seismically resistant, and that cost is on the order of $3 to $4 billion. Our concern with these cost estimates is that the devil is in the details in these levee systems, and I want to underscore the word system. They're not a cross-section, and talking about what the cross-section is or how high the cross-section is not really talking about the system. They have penetrations through them, they have gates in them, they have geologic conditions that vary significantly along them, and they really need to be treated as a system. This photograph shows an example of one of the failures in Hurricane Katrina, and what I'll point out is how much of that levee system didn't fail, and there's one location. It's a system, and it's only as good as its weakest link. So estimating the cost really requires going into the details, and we don't believe that that work has been done yet for this system. To give some context for this, in New Orleans after Katrina, the cost estimate to repair the system and bring it back to the 100-year protection level was on the order of $3 to $5 billion in 2005, and in 2007 it was up to $8 billion, and as of today it's $16 billion that we've spent doing that. So a cost estimate, and that system's 350 miles long, you've got 1,000 miles of levees here. We're just skeptical. It doesn't mean you might not be able to do it for the $4 billion that's reported here, but I'd like for you all to have your eyes wide open that it may be significantly more than that. Another limitation is that the need for evacuation planning and public safety is not emphasized in this report. This is something the authors have acknowledged, and the authors are planning to emphasize it more in the report. Their thinking was that it was already emphasized many other places, and they didn't feel the need to do that again here. But I just want to point out that that's really the first issue that we ought to all be looking at, and in the charge to the authors, it was actually the first issue that they were charged with looking at. What I've shown here is a graph which shows the possible deaths if a flood were to happen along the bottom, and along the vertical axis is how likely it is that something bad will happen. And we use graphs like this to manage risk and to get a sense for where we are in terms of the level of risk relative to other systems or benchmarks. And on that graph, there's a line which is what we use in the United States for major dams, such as the dams that are upriver from the Delta. And what I've plotted there is based on the DREAMS work where the Delta levee risk is relative to what we would expect or require for major dams in our country and in the state of California. And what you'll note is that the risk in the Delta to public safety is orders of magnitude, 1,000 times greater than the risk due to dams in the United States that we have said is acceptable. So we're really pushing things here, and we need to understand that there's public safety, and that should be number one. And the second point I want to make about this is you can improve this risk by making the levees more reliable, But you can also improve this risk by making it so that when there are floods, and there will be floods, people don't die. And there are generally simple ways of doing that, but it means communicating clearly with the public, it means working with the public, and it means a consistent level of participation. It's not something where you have a public service ad and say you really need to be careful and then 10 years later not do anything. It requires a sustained investment. And what I want to point out as well is where the New Orleans levee system is. You'll note, first of all, that as of 2011, for fatalities on the order of 10 to 100 in a flood event, you actually have greater risk here than there is in New Orleans as of today. The second thing I want to point out about the New Orleans system is that in 2005, you can see where the risk was. And after about $16 billion, you can see where the risk now is. And you'll hear engineers say, well, we reduced the risk by 92%, which sounds like a huge reduction in risk. But when you look at it in the context of where that is relative to what we require for dams in the United States, we really have barely made a dent in improving public safety. And if you'll note, the curve for the New Orleans system in 2011 has shifted to the left. The reason that it shifted to the left is because about half as many people now live in New Orleans versus in 2005. So I just want to emphasize, in terms of public safety, you can spend a lot of money upgrading levees and you may not have much of an impact, and you can spend likely a lot less money working with the public and working with property and protecting property in ways so that when it does flood, it's not going to be catastrophic and have a much bigger impact. The last limitation is there's a contention in the plan that improving the levees will improve the reliability of the water supply, and our panel has pushed back on that contention. The first part of that is the idea of improving the levees for seismic events potentially will improve the reliability of the water supply. That was something that the DREAMS effort spent a lot of time looking at. And I think one of the outcomes of that work that surprised all of us who were involved with it is that the seismic risk to the water supply really is not that significant. And I want to point out two aspects of the results. This table is taken from the Phase 2 DREAMS work, and it shows two scenarios of investing money in the Delta to improve the system. One is upgrading the levees throughout the Delta, which is similar to what the Economic Sustainability Plan is proposing, not the details of exactly how they're upgraded, but the idea. Or armoring the in-Delta conveyance for water to get to the pumps and increasing the seismic resistance of a pathway through the Delta to get water to the pumps. And what you'll note is if you look at the catastrophic floods where we lose 10 or 20 or 30 islands due to a large earthquake, there is no 0% reduction in the disruption to the water supply over the next 100 years, which was the time frame for this. Now, you could argue that maybe there's a way of upgrading the system where there is going to be more of an effect, and that's something I think you could do with the modeling that's been done and would need to be done in order to justify that statement that you're going to have much of an impact on the reliability of the water supply. The other side of this is if you look at the consequences of disruptions to the water supply due to earthquakes, as far as I can tell reading through DREAMS Phase 2, in a 100-year window, the net present value of that is about $2 billion. So what that means is at most you expect to lose $2 billion due to earthquakes in the next 100 years due to disruptions to the water supply, which does not in any way justify spending $10 billion, for example, on an isolated conveyance facility. So I think the point I want to make is that the reliability of the water supply due to earthquakes is only one piece of what we're talking about, and I think the reliability of the water supply due to disruptions from salinity is a much bigger impact. I know in three of the last 4 years there have been disruptions due to that, and there haven't been any earthquakes that have affected the water supply in those 4 years. So I would just encourage everyone who's making these decisions to be clear about what we're talking about and what the threats are and what the threats aren't. One other recommendation I would have is that the DREAMS Phase 2 be reviewed. It has not been reviewed. I think there's useful information in there. I think it could be even more useful if it were reviewed. One of our comments in DREAMS Phase 1 was that it was difficult to read, and I think the independent review made the report a much better report and much easier to understand, and I think the same goes for DREAMS Phase 2. I had a heck of a time wading through that and understanding what those results meant, and so I think it would really benefit from someone reviewing that work. So with that, what I'd like to do is summarize our recommendations to the authors. Number one is to emphasize and provide guidance for public safety. Number two is to expand the discussion about the consequences of levee failures and provide more explicit guidance on prioritization for investments. Number three is to coordinate with the public and the state and the federal agencies to develop standards for levees in the Delta. This is not something where somebody can say, we think we ought to do this. This is an issue where everybody's going to have to sit down in a room, maybe with the door shut, but with everyone who's a stakeholder participating, and come up with a way that seems to make sense for this system. Number four is to better substantiate the cost estimate for levee upgrades and provide realistic ranges. At a minimum, we'd just like some discussion about if all of the assumptions don't happen, then how expensive might these upgrades be. Number five, which is related, would be to discuss risk and uncertainty in the results. Number six is to work on defining and assessing sustainability in a way that's more viable, that's more useful in terms of figuring out how we can do better for the economy. And number seven is to provide more detail on some of the economic modeling, some of the details of the modeling, for example, for how salinity would impact the economy need to be just expressed and explained a little bit more clearly. And lastly, we had some guidance to you all. The first one is to develop strategies to implement a user fee system to address the public goods nature of the Delta. And this is letter this morning, I guess, speaks right to this. But there is precedent for this in the 2008 Economic Analysis Guidebook for the California Department of Water Resources. It specifically talks about this, that the people who benefit, the entities who benefit from flood protection should also bear some of the cost of that flood protection. The second is to conduct a comprehensive and credible cost-benefit analysis to analyze these alternatives. So you now have the information to do this. We have a model with DREAMS to do this. I think it's time that somebody sit down and take all of this and start looking at possible viable alternatives and what those impacts are of those different alternatives. The third is to work with the public and the state and the federal agencies to develop standards for levees in the Delta. One thing that I would say is if there are levees protecting people, then I think it's pretty clear that there's a minimum standard in the United States that we have for those types of levees, and those need to be brought up to that without question. I don't think there's a debate there. It's when we start talking about levees that are not protecting people where we really need to talk about what's going to make sense. And the levees that are protecting people, if we're requiring a certain level of protection in Sacramento, I think it's going to be hard to explain why you're not going to require that same level of protection for people in the Delta who don't live in Sacramento. Number four is to look at including the cost for mitigating economic as well as environmental impacts to the Delta in analyzing water export alternatives. So this impact analysis points out that if you take water away from the Delta, there are going to be economic impacts. So one way of mitigating that is to figure out, if you did take water away, how could you mitigate those impacts, either to prevent the impacts or to compensate for those impacts. And the cost of that ought to be part of the cost of taking water around the Delta. Another is to work with the local stakeholders to develop a prioritization plan for investing.
future resources in the Delta, and the last is to take immediate steps to improve maintenance and monitoring for the existing levees. No matter what you do with the levees, there will always be a threat to the people and to the public, and that needs to be acknowledged, and everything needs to be done to make sure that people are aware of that threat and that people are prepared for that threat. So with that, what I'd like to do is see if you have any questions. Is that how you want to do this? And then all of us have the opportunity to address those questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Members. Just gone.
Yeah, just one question. I think once we've heard from all the parties, then we can probably delve into a little deeper. But just, Dr. Gilbert, thanks for your presentation, certainly for the panel's peer review. One reference back to the on the limitation side of it, on the cost estimates of upgrading levees, and the reference, I've read the background material beyond the size of the slideshow, that, you know, we used the Katrina situation, but again, there needs to be, there certainly needs to be realistic estimates, but also acknowledging those differences that were, you know, there's the, you know, the need to import material where the Corps of Engineers through the federal government and a crisis response is doing the work and your bid climate is different. All those things, again, are factors that may or may not be in place in a given area, but I think those are, and I don't know how much the panel looked at those things, but I think those are very important because I think part of the assumptions, and there is some discussion of that in the document, certainly in the plan itself in its draft form, about, you know, the fact that local agencies, and that may be the local reclamation districts, obviously in concert with state funding and or in some cases state, and certainly in few cases the Corps, but for the most part that 1,100 miles of levee system have been responsibility of local districts, again with some state subvention, and certainly we've had much discussion about response if there is a crisis, but I think that's the, you know, that is the setting by which you make the estimates, and again, it may or may not be similar to Katrina. So I guess I'm kind of curious, did you take some of that into account in your, you know, discussions and analysis? Because that would provide potentially billions of dollars of range and difference, depending on what you use as your background. So,
yes, we did, and I acknowledge that it's different,
yeah. Yeah.
And it may be that it could cost significantly less. The difference we're talking about, though, is about a factor of 20. So I find it hard to believe that it will be 1/20th of what it cost in New Orleans. The other aspect of this is this fat levee requires a lot of borrow material. And if it's going to be borrow material that's of the quality that you need, I'm not sure where all that borrow material is going to come from. And that's what happened in New Orleans. One of the reasons the cost increased so significantly was when they worked out how much material this was really going to take and what quality of material they needed to do this, they had to barge material from Mississippi, which became very expensive. What I also don't appreciate is how much right-of-way or land acquisition would be needed in order to do what you're talking about. And I just, you know, sitting in Texas, suspect that if there's now a demand on this right-of-way, a demand on this land, that the price is going to go up for the land because that's capitalism and that's what will happen in the United States. So I am wary of assuming that everyone's going to say, fine, you can take the land, you can build a fat levee, and sure, you can build a borrow pit in the middle of my land and take the material to do that, and I'm not going to charge you very much for this. That's just not the American way.
Yeah, just following on to after we discussed the American way, as it relates to certainly national standards, as part of I think developing the standard, and that's borne out in some of your recommendations. But one of the things, I've certainly spoken to this in this setting with members of the Stewardship Council, but also as we've had discussions at the Protection Commission and even in the local setting, which I serve on the Board of Supervisors here in Sacramento County, is the concern that with the national standard, and again, I think the awareness of where the legacy towns, again, the population in the immediate primary zone is, you know, not an order of magnitudes of hundreds of thousands or millions, but, in, you know, a few thousand, that if you were to impose that standard as the standard, I say impose in a way you use that, you look at the physical construct of the towns that have been there for, in some cases, going on, you know, 120 to 150 years, that the levy sections themselves would basically wipe out the footprint of the communities. I mean, because if you take those back and you look at the slopes and that even if money weren't a concern and that there was a willingness to do that, that the footprints themselves, the physical footprint of the levee construct, and you could just see what's going on in Natomas here in north of the city of Sacramento, and look at that and take the town of Cortland, town of Walnut Grove, and it doesn't take, you know, an engineer to figure out that you wipe out, you know, several blocks of the town, which are only several blocks deep in a lot of cases. And so I think in that's part of the issue that's going to have to be looked at, is that if you have a standard and you want to have protection and acknowledge the threat, I think those are all very important things, and do your best to minimize the risk. But if you impose that same standard of the 200-year protection or even the 100-year with all the profiles, that, you know, again, I'm not an engineer, but it becomes physically very, very difficult to do that and still preserve the community, which were the inhabitants, and that's the vitality of the human activity anyway in the Delta. And I don't know, was there any discussion, again, about that, about, you know, it's one thing to say, yeah, it needs to be the same, but what, in practical terms, what does that mean?
Right. So I guess the first part about that is it needs to be whatever, if the federal government is involved and if you're going to rely on the federal government for flood insurance, then it needs to be whatever the standard is that the federal government requires for that. And that's been something that's become pretty hotly discussed and pretty well refined at this point. So I think it'd be hard to go around that if what you're going to do is try to be a part of the National Flood Insurance Program. Does that mean there are ways you could do it without working with the federal government or without being part of the federal flood insurance program? I think there are. And, you know, maybe there are local insurance mechanisms that you could use so that if there is a flood, there's a way of mitigating the consequences of that flood. It's not always, you can make the levees as high as you want, but I don't know that you can always rely on them, because the land is sinking, water levels are rising. Some of the climate models that were done for DREAMS showed the 100-year flood level increasing by 10 feet or more in some areas of the Delta potentially over the next 100 years. So you could spend a lot of money on a levee, and in 50 years it'd be obsolete. So I really think thinking in terms of levees as the only way of helping these communities is narrow. I think we really need to look at broader ways of helping those communities that complement what's there and maybe enhance the levee, maybe not. The last part of your question, there are ways of increasing the height of flood protection without expanding the width of a levee. There are things like flood walls that we can put in, or there are, if you look at the whole system, you could maybe put gates in the system such that when water gets to a certain level, it gets diverted around, and so that it doesn't impact the levees in that particular area. But that requires really looking at the whole system.
Okay, thanks.
Randy?
You devoted some discussion to water quality and particularly salinity as it relates to potential conveyance improvements that are under consideration. And as you well know, currently there is a significant conflict between the water supply delivery system that depends upon the Delta and the reverse flows that creates in the South and the Southern Delta. But there's a commensurate benefit with water quality bringing that Sacramento River water through the Delta. It seems like from an economic evaluation that there should be a look at what are the alternative means of providing good quality water for farming in the Central and the South Delta and the costs associated with that versus simply siphoning water out of the Delta channels. Is that something that the peer review group looked at, discussed, talked about, considered?
Other than to say, no, we agree with you. We agree with that approach should be taken. So it's got to be looked at as a system.
Felicia, did you?
Yeah, and this, I apologize if this is just a lack of caffeination on my part yesterday and today, but there's sort of a key point that, you know, I didn't have a pen, so I sort of notched the page last night, and that I see again on the slide, which is a point I know is very clear to you, it may be to everybody but me, but can you talk a little bit more to a layperson about the point you're making about water supply reliability and the earthquake issue? Because there are camps on this that have come to us with widely differing views of what the impact of the seismicity. We've had USGS and others, I guess Met Video and all of that, that make it seem that it is inevitable that we are going to have this catastrophic cascade of levee failures, which have impact, all kinds of impacts, but one impact is the water supply reliability in not only the Southern Delta, but for export, and that is a state interest. Then on the other hand, we have people who say that's completely overblown, and it's been overblown by people who want an isolated facility for other reasons, so they're overplaying their hand there. I would just like you to, I see the chart, I can't really follow it, and I read the paragraph, and I just would like your view of that issue. It sounds like you have an opinion, but I couldn't understand it physically.
The source of information that I have is the DREAMS work, and that's all I know of where somebody has tried to look at or use that model to figure out what the risk from earthquakes would be and what the impacts would be to the Delta in a variety of ways, including disruptions to the water supply. And that work indicated that, yes, an earthquake is possible, that a large earthquake could have significant impact to the levees in the Delta and could cause significant flooding in the Delta. Mm-hmm. What it also showed was that the consequence on the water supply was not that significant, that it would not take that long for the system to recover, that the cost of that disruption and the chance of it happening, which is not certain, but it's possible, is such that, you know, in a 100-year window, the today value dollars, it's about $2.5 billion, something like that, is the expected cost of that kind of an event disrupting the water supply in the Delta.
But what is that? Can you paint a picture of what that means? Does that mean one event when it's down for 2 months and it's in 1 year, or is it bits and pieces of that? I just, not having read the DREAM study, I actually don't know what, when you say,
yeah, what happens?
How do you recover from it?
Right. I don't know. These are some of the details that aren't in the draft or the report that I've looked at as to exactly what makes up that risk. In the DREAMS phase one work, when we looked at that, the disruptions to the water supply were primarily very significant earthquake events, which were not very likely. So the roughly in 100 years, you know, if a big earthquake like that happened, if I remember right, it was on the order of $15 billion to $40 billion, somewhere in there would be the cost of something like that. A lot of that is not the water supply reliability, though. That's other issues, other mm-hmm. damage in the Delta. But the chance of that is not very high. So when you look at a 100-year window, the expected cost, which is the chance of it times what it would be if it really did happen, is not that significant. It's several billion dollars. Now, billions of dollars are significant, mm-hmm. but it's not $10 billion and it's not $20 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But the details, I would defer, that this is not my area of expertise. You know, Jeff Mount could probably come up and answer that question better. They looked at lots of scenarios of what would happen if you had this kind of an earthquake and you had these kinds of failures of levees. And the bottom line was that I think all of us were surprised that it wasn't the Armageddon in terms of the water supply that people thought it was. Now, there's a lot of other awful consequences of something like that happening, but it wasn't the water supply that was really governing those consequences.
Gloria.
You may have already answered this, but are there other models out there that would be contrary to what the DREAM study says that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Were you referring to Jeff Mount? for that, or are you aware of any other models?
No, to my understanding, the DREAMS work and subsequent work that's been going on since then, looking at emergency preparedness, was the attempt by the state of California to put all of the best information available and to try to understand this problem. So I do not know of something as an alternative to that.
There have been other attempts to quantify the risk, and for example, there was a model that was developed, I've heard it referred to as an RMA model, where they looked at what's likely to happen, what are the possibilities. So in terms of water supply, they've actually modeled it. Much of the time, if we had a massive earthquake in the wintertime when we had high flows, then the impacts on the water supply system are much less. So the time that you're really worried about is if you have one of those major earthquakes in July during a drought year. That's when, or August, or some other low flow time when you don't have much water available, and to maintain salinity in the delta, you'd have to release a lot of water from reservoirs. So there have been other modeling efforts there. I think the DREAMS 2 study that they're referring to has the best technical information, but other modeling efforts have been done, which I think basically confirm that. I think as I understand the basic economics of a massive failure, you're talking about impacts that would probably be, first of all, understand in that event, you're likely to have major urban areas that are disrupted, and many, many billions of dollars of damage in the urban areas. In the Delta, the key impacts would, first of all, the largest impact would be on local communities and local interests. I've actually read a blog by Jeff here that says it's 50%, and he's more of an expert on the DREAM study, 50% for local interest, 25% for transportation.
80%.
80%, okay.
Yeah.
80% local interest. So you could talk about what those numbers are, but in any event, most of the impacts aren't on the water supply system. That said, the impacts on the water supply system could be very, very significant if they happened at the wrong time. And sometimes, in order to prevent that really catastrophic thing, you have to look at that risk. So, as Dr. Gilbert's saying, the summation of all the risks, and I have no reason to disbelieve the DREAMS 2 study, would say the net present value of those improvements is $2.5 billion.
As far as I can tell. On that order.
Yeah.
And it's not years that the water supply is disrupted. It's on the order of months that the water supply is disrupted.
Right. I agree. The modeling that I've seen says 3 or 4 months is the most likely bad case scenario.
Randy.
Well, that begs the question, why in our recommendations do we ask local agencies to do 6, 18, and 36-month water supply planning analysis in the event of a catastrophic failure in the Delta if we're only talking about 2 or 3 months?
We actually, it's not all based on earthquakes in the Delta, and it's actually based on recommendations that DWR has for contractors now, so that we actually used some of the information that DWR provided. So not all of the risks to the water system are the catastrophic failure in the Delta. You could have a massive failure, for example, of the aqueduct in another place caused by an earthquake or other problems.
Dr. Gilbert, thank you very much. This is a good discussion, and I appreciate you doing it. Just based on your knowledge, and I know from reading your biography, you've worked in these areas a lot. What's the hesitation of government to include evacuation information meaningfully in their deliberations? If not here, generally. I mean, I have ideas, but I'd kind of like to know what a serious student of the subject would say.
Right. I think number one is human nature. We like to think that we're going to be okay and that there's an easy fix. And so building things makes us feel safer, whereas acknowledging and constantly being reminded that you're not safe and you may be in jeopardy and you need to prepare for that makes people not feel so good. So politically, I think there's a tendency to try to build things and make people feel good and not to remind them of the threats that they face. I think in terms of the system, it's difficult to do this. You're talking about people, and you can't force them to evacuate. You can just facilitate their ability to evacuate. So it's a reluctance in that you can't control it the way you can control building a bigger wall or building a gate. In New Orleans, I would say, even after we spent $16 billion building big walls and big gates, there's a huge need for us to be educating the public about what the risks really are and all the simple things they can do to be prepared for the next hurricane and the next time that it floods. And I think it's our responsibility. So I'm not a government official, so I can say that. I'm a professor in an ivory tower, but I think it's...
No, hardly an ivory tower, but you deal with very practical and tangible subjects. Is there Dr. Robert Gilbert top five list of practical things to do that people won't want to hear that will actually educate them about risk and behavior and consequences?
I would have to think about
okay.
the top five. But I would say there's an entire community that's devoted to this and that are experts in how you do this. There was a fellow I worked with, Professor Dennis Maletti from the University of Colorado. This is his area of expertise, whether it's a nuclear war that you're talking about or a catastrophe at a nuclear power plant or a catastrophic flood or a catastrophic earthquake. And he's done quite a bit of work in California looking at earthquake preparedness and making sure the public is prepared and that, there are always, for any given event, there are simple things you can do. Like for a flood, don't put your wedding album on the floor of your closet. Put it up on the shelf. Just simple things that people don't think about unless they're constantly reminded that they may get wet sometime and they ought to think about what's going to happen when that occurs.
How easily do you find broaching the subject of development to be in the Delta and looking at your projection chart? I assume if the population increases, the risk, the number of people at risk would also increase.
Yes. So can you ask the question again? I'm not sure.
Well, I'm interested. The Delta is developing certainly at the fringes, and you can argue that the risk there is less than in the very heart and center of the Delta, but it's not without risk. And one of the things we've been reluctant as a society to do, other than changing human behavior on personal things like putting your family album on the bottom of the closet rather than the top, is facing up to the question of what new development in flood-threatened areas might mean, kind of the repeat situation of the Mississippi. Mr. Natoli mentioned the legacy towns, which have their own unique comparable parallels along the Mississippi, but there don't seem to be any popular solutions that anyone comes up with.
Right. Well, so development in the Delta, I would defer to the experts here on development and restrictions on development. I think land use is one way that we have of mitigating risks from events like floods and earthquakes, and it's a very important mechanism that we have. So I would defer that question to the people who are experts in the Delta itself.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for chairing this panel and giving the discussion. Any other question, members? Okay, Mr. Machado, then Mr. Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to remind the council, this report was started in earnest in March and was completed with the draft that was peer-reviewed in October. And so we did have a very truncated and very intense time.
Mike, pull that closer to you, if you would, please.
I want to thank the peer review panel because they've identified areas of concern, and they've also identified some strength of it that I think helps take care of that truncated time that we've had to deal with. And I'll turn it over to Jeff Michael, who will address the issues that were raised by the peer review panel.
Before you do that, I left the Delta Protection Commission meeting before you concluded. Do you have an approximate date for revisions, modifications, completions, and issuing the final report? I understand it's approximate.
Yes, we're looking at presenting the amendments based on the peer review to the council, to the commission, in the January meeting, which will be the 26th or the fourth Thursday. And then that at the same time, it'll be available for the council.
Okay. And then assuming they adopt it without change, we'd get the formal copy a day or so later.
Yes. I think commission has agreed to deal with the limited presentation of the response to the peer review panel rather than having a very open discourse.
What did you just say, Don?
If we get it done on Thursday night, we'll have it for you Friday morning.
Got it. Okay.
I know. That's right. Yeah.
And we'll be meeting then the following day, so we'll get it. It probably will come back to the council at the first meeting in February.
Yeah. So. Okay. All right. I understand that. Dr. Michael.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the science program for convening and coordinating the review panel of the economic sustainability plan. I'd like to thank Dr. Gilbert for the useful feedback from that. Agree with most of his comments. For the most part, and the review panel has actually validated the economic analysis in the economic sustainability plan, including several important elements have been the target of some inaccurate criticism, as illustrated in the letter sent to Chair Eisenberg this morning. The review panel stated...
You're talking about the state agency letter?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm a little surprised by some of the stuff at the end of that. The review panel stated that the technical economic chapters were, quote, well-drafted and use appropriate techniques, end quote. In particular, the panel commended the modeling utilized for agricultural crop choice and salinity impacts, calling it, quote, state-of-the-art in their November 2nd presentation. And I know that your own consulting staff thought that this was a good model and use of very modern techniques and a contribution to literature as well. The review panel also validated some key findings in the economic sustainability regarding the Delta levy system that are too often overlooked. The review panel largely concurred with the recommendation with respect to the PL 8499 standard and recommended that even higher standards comparable to urban levies should be used for levies that protect human life. The review panel found that the ESP, quote, substantiates the importance of lowland levies and, quote, provides a potential viable alternative to improve the reliability of lowland levies. So I'm reiterating a few things here, but I think they're important, and that's why I'm reiterating them. Some Delta studies downplay the importance of lowland levees because they're typically found on islands with predominantly agricultural use. And Dr. Gilbert just cautioned about island-by-island cost-benefit analysis and how that can be a deceptive way or incorrect way to look at a levee system. In contrast, the Economic Sustainability Plan and other engineering studies point out failure of lowland levees put more stress on the overall integrity of the levee system. So the concept of matching levee investment to land use ignores the fact that levees work together as a system and that levees adjacent to lower value land uses can be the most critical to the stability of the system. Also, non-land-based uses, such as Delta shipping channels, Delta boating, which is most popular in the channels protected by lowland levees in agricultural areas, and water conveyance are not connected to the land use behind the levee. The review panel stated that, quote, the concept of a fat levee has merit and may prove to be feasible and effective means to improve the stability of the levees. I also like to comment on some of the panel's recommendations for the Stewardship Council because some of those parallel things in the ESP. For example, the panel recommends the Stewardship Council conduct a credible and consistent cost-benefit analysis of Delta options. That echoes a recommendation that's on page 3 and 4 in Chapter 1 of the Economic Sustainability Plan. The review panel highlighted the public goods nature of the delta, the problem of free riding behavior of public and private beneficiaries on the levy system. The panel states, quote, "We believe an equitable outcome concerning the distribution of benefits and costs of levy expenditures will ultimately require an agency with the authority to assign and assess beneficiaries their share of the costs." I know that's something that this council has discussed as well. The panel also recognized the negative impacts of proposed isolated conveyance on the delta and states, quote, "Given that water exporters will be the primary beneficiaries of such a conveyance system, the DPC and DSC need to ensure that sponsors of a conveyance system fully pay for any and all delta mitigation." So having restated a few of those concepts, let me talk about some of the limitations. First, the panel noted the emergency response evacuation planning was inadequate in the economic sustainability plan. We completely agree with that, and we've already taken significant steps to bolster this. We've engaged Ron Baldwin, a well-known emergency management expert in the area, to strengthen these areas in the report and actually produce a new appendix that will have detailed action strategies that can be taken in this area. And this is probably the biggest change that we anticipate for the recommendations, and maybe really the only new recommendation that we expect to come out would be something that calls out these emergency response actions specifically and pulls them to the top level. A second comment is that some of the economic sustainability plan recommendations are not valid from a statewide perspective because they're not a cost-benefit analysis. As mentioned, we agree the need for cost-benefit analysis, but we'll emphasize that our analysis was required to be based on achieving economic sustainability in the Delta within the context and constraints of the co-equal goals. And so that's the way we approached it. We were reminded continually of those co-equal goals. Joe did a great job of reminding me about the co-equal goals. But it is important to note that there has been some cost-benefit work, particularly in the DREAMS Phase 2 analysis, which is already described. I agree. DREAMS Phase 2 needs a peer review and people to take that to the finish line because it's not there yet, but the information within it is tremendously important, and it's a great effort. But there are some things in Department of Water Resources' own DREAMS 2 Phase 2 report that we will point out that have implications for cost-benefit analysis. First, in the DREAMS Phase 2 report that they did complete, the so-called improved levy scenario was found to have the highest benefit-cost ratio of all four scenarios analyzed, including the isolated conveyance scenario. Improving levies had the highest economic benefit bang for the buck. Second, water export interruptions only account for 20% of the economic costs associated with a large earthquake scenario that would flood between 10 and 30 Delta Islands. Third, water export interruption accounts for less than 2% of the economic costs associated with non-seismic flood events such as storms. And I would add that water export interruptions account for 0% of the loss of life from any of these hazards. And these findings are why improving levies perform well on benefit cost analysis, is that although they may not do as much for water supply reliability as an isolated conveyance, they do make a contribution to that as well as a whole host of other important economic values that are both in Delta and also have statewide implications when we're talking about the energy system, electricity distribution, natural gas, et cetera, et cetera. A third comment, the cost of the FAT levy concept needs further substantiation, and the performance of it needs more analysis. We agree, we're working on this. One thing I'll note is that in our research on seismically upgrade levies in the Delta, we recently learned that seismic levy upgrades were originally part of the DREAMS Phase 2 analysis and were identified as the lowest cost of three high-ranking risk reduction strategies in a January 2000 report to the legislature that described DREAMS Phase 2 preliminary results. However, the seismically improved levies were not present in the final DREAMS Phase 2 report. So we've requested more information about this building block from DWR and what some of the preliminary findings are, and we hope to receive that because We think that that will be very important. We also note 2007 PPIC report described a so-called Fortress Delta option with costs in the $4 billion range, and that the costs we did develop were in consultation with engineers who build Delta levees. And at least on the PL8499 stuff, these guys are out there doing those projects right now in the field, and Mike can verify this because you're out on the site. They're actually reporting costs coming in on the low end of this $1 to $2 million range per mile on the projects they're working on now. We did double the base engineering construction costs to allow for additional program management costs. But they're right. I mean, to really get a cost estimate of this, you'd have to get do a much more detailed analysis that goes beyond the cross sections. So we can work on that, but we think the appropriate responses concern is to get seismically upgraded levees on the analysis agenda of both the Stewardship Council and the BDCP, because people probably aren't going to believe our cost estimates no matter what we come up with. We think it needs to get on the agenda and have other independent people look at it. A concern about the definition of economic sustainability. This is that has been a little bit problematic throughout the review. I think the review panel noted that we get a little bit boxed in on that. But that is a change that I'll make in the revision to allow for more substitution between sectors. And is actually something that was discussed in an earlier draft of the economic sustainability plan and caused some consternation amongst the commissioners. But one thing to emphasize is that the some of the things we found is the substitution possibilities are somewhat limited. And even though there is projected growth in, for example, tourism and recreation, our findings were the projected growth of that might equal 5% of what they're getting from Delta agriculture today. And so, the potential to offset some losses may be there, but let's not get overly excited about what could potentially happen in that area. And the ability to grow other areas is pretty limited because we don't want the Delta to urbanize for very good reasons. And so it's difficult to develop an urban service economy. And so the substitution possibilities are less extensive than we might think, but we'll be sure to discuss that more. And the last one is on the idea that improving levees won't improve water supply reliability. This is the one comment where we respectfully disagree with the panel and think that it could have substantial risks. One thing I want to point out is that the slide Bob shows from Dreams Phase 2, and one of the things that I think is important from the potential peer review is that improved levies scenario in Dreams Phase 2 looks nothing like the improved levies recommendation in the economic sustainability plan. In fact, that's just a PL8499 upgrade and nothing beyond that. Like I said, the early report said that they were going to look at options beyond that, but they weren't included in the final report. So, and we've requested that. So there's nothing on this that that resembles actually what we're talking about. It just looks at getting to the PL8499 standard. And we think that analysis would be very useful.
Mr. Kreinstaff?
The one question that I have after looking at all of this is, it's clear to me that if we spent billions, whatever the right number of billions are on the levees, we would reduce risk and that would be better for the region. What it's not clear to me is who should pay for that. If, as I understand, the Delta region itself benefits 50% and 20 or 30% is for other utilities and other infrastructure, and then 20% is the state water system. Does that imply that if you developed a program that the Delta residents and landowners themselves should pay 50% of the cost of upgrading the levees? And what happens if, in fact, the cost for this program is $5 billion and there's not $5 billion there? And what are the recommendations if we don't have the money, and who should pay?
That's a good comment, and I think that this is some useful. I think you could use the Dreams analysis to sort of inform the distribution of costs. And I should point out that it's not 20% water export and 80% in Delta. It's 80% that is not water export. Now, a lot of that is statewide interest, too. And, you know, we'll have to look at the data to see more how that is disaggregated. But for the big earthquake scenarios, and that might be what you would use to underlie seismic upgrades to levees, at least what I've seen in the Dreams Phase 2 suggests that 20% of the cost of that would be placed on the water export system. 20% of the cost of that would be placed on the state highway system. We've got another 60% there where we'd have to dig into the details. Some of that would be local. Some of that would be the energy system. There's an awful lot of value moving through there in terms of fuel through pipelines and electricity transmission. Some of it would be the local landowners and other, you know, all these values. So we could sort of disaggregate that and use it as a template.
So that is what you're saying. Okay, good.
Yeah, it is what I'm saying. And so, but we'd have to see that detailed data to give an idea of what that might look like.
And what if those sectors can't come up with that money? And what is kind of the fallback? I mean, that's, from my perspective, that's one of the big challenges, is there isn't enough money to do all of the things that...
Well, you're right. I mean, but this is a problem you're having on the conveyance, too, right? I mean, we haven't seen a financial plan that works on that as well. But I think we need to take the analysis of this sort of to the next level, get an idea of what those costs may be. And I think, you know, you have what economists call free rider problem here. And I think that people will be more willing to pay if they see that there's an effective mechanism that's getting everyone to contribute their share. And I do believe that it's possible that the costs might be manageable if they're actually distributed across all of the values that do exist. I mean, the phase two analysis showed that improving levies provided $6.8 in benefits for every $1 in costs. It shows that the values is there, so that you ought to be able to devise a feasible plan. Now, there's legal issues that I'm not informed on about who you can charge, but...
Well, what we'll do when we get to public comments, we'll see how flexible the interested parties are on cost-sharing ratios in anticipation of Mr. Michael's comment that perhaps a more reasoned approach can develop. God, I hope that's true. Okay. Mr. Michael, had you concluded your comments? Okay. Questions by members? Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, we appreciate you coming in at the last minute. And Dr. Gilbert, again, I want to thank you for serving on the panel. It's an imposition, but an important one to get the perspective of experts on things. And we deeply appreciate you and your colleagues' work. And we'll look forward to the finished product in January and then the February hearing of the council.
I don't know if Dan was going to say anything, but we did get the letter was kind of the late receipt, and obviously it'll get, I guess, incorporated into some of the final responses. But you know, I did read with interest some of that. I don't know if Dan, you were going to comment.
Yeah, we just wanted to make sure that you were aware of the key points it made, since this is a letter from the cabinet secretaries representing food and agriculture, transportation, and natural resources, and we did just get it today. And as with the review panel, they've are encouraged by some portions of the sustainability strategy. They like the recommendations about growing agritourism and recreation, considering the value of infrastructure as we plan for levy improvements, fully evaluating options for conveyance through the Delta. But they did outline a number of concerns, and some of those echo some of the, what I heard Dr. Gilbert say as well. There is a concern whether the cost forecasts for levy improvements will really prove to be realistic, and they are encouraging more evaluation of the cost effectiveness and the benefits of versus the cost of improvements on individual islands. There's a concern that the recommendations of the ESP attempt to lock the Delta into a status quo, a protection of the status quo, and there's two places in which they point that out. One is the suggestion that we would just maintain and enhance the value of Delta agriculture without really suggesting how that might occur. The other is a suggestion that salinity in the Delta can't be reduced, but it actually, if possible, ought to be increased. And they point out that the often salinity in the delta exceeds current water quality standards that the state board has set, and they're pointing out that that's the proper location for those decisions to be made. And there's also a concern that the economic sustainability plan doesn't anticipate the restoration work that the BDCP will be proposing in terms of finding ways to accommodate that. Instead, it seems to be suggesting that that work could be inappropriate, and similarly raises questions about the conveyance proposal. So I think they're just trying to put themselves on record, as I see it. Caltrans also, you know, is the manager.
Caltrans is impoverished without money, yeah. And it's legally impermissible to use any of their money for Delta levies, a position I find highly amusing.
So we just wanted to make sure you're aware of that.
Yes, yes.
They'd have a hard time traveling those roads if the water wasn't held back by levees, I can assure you. Highway 12 and Highway 4 would have a difficult time functioning. I just want to ask one question, though. It was raised in the letter, and maybe it goes to Dr. Gilbert, because I think as you cited the credentials of the folks that were on the peer review panel, this doesn't necessarily take exception with the panel members, but says that the panel would have been better informed by having folks from the state and or university system as a part of the panel. But as I heard you describe, you had three folks who have, you know, strong backgrounds in agricultural economics. And so do you think that again, not to discredit anybody, but that the panel would have been better off if it had included those folks? Or do you think you had sufficient coverage relative to your panelists to make the judgments you did relative to the agricultural aspects and the economic sustainability components of that?
Yes. Well, I asked our three economists that question after reading the letter this morning, and they all felt very comfortable with their knowledge of what was done and how it was done. They also pointed out that one of the groups they suggested they should have gotten a reviewer from is the University of California Extension. Well, they were a part of the work that they did, so it's maybe not wise to get somebody to review the work that
they were part of,
was produced by you. So I, to our best knowledge, we were competent in what we did and feel comfortable with our conclusions.
Okay.
Dr. Adams was also a product of the University of California, David.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, there you are.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it a great deal. Okay, we have two requests to speak. Mr. Zlotnick from the State and Federal Water Contractors. Mr. Zlotnick, somewhere. There he is. Okay. Or, Greg, if you want to just speak from the table, that's fine, too. Whatever seems. Is that, yeah. Grab the mic over there, if you will, please. That seems to have a little better volume than.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Greg Zlotnick with State and Federal Contractors. Just a few comments and actually a question for Dr. Gilbert, actually, that hopefully will help inform one of the recommendations. First of all, just quickly, in the letter that you were just discussing from the state agencies, either I heard it wrong, but I'd like to quote from the letter about I believe I heard a statement that said water quality standards are violated. At times, and in fact, the letter states that often water quality for Delta supplies is better than the board standards. That's what's actually in the letter. So I want to make sure we get that correct. Then, in terms of the discussion about conveyance and the costs and the impacts, and both Joe alluded to it and the report, and actually Dr. Michael down at the Delta Protection Commission, if you're looking only at the sort of benefits of the structural integrity of the system, that's one thing. But we've also got the whole issue of what happens if there is a failure in terms of the economic impact of the state, disruption of economic activity, et cetera, as Joe alluded to. If it happens during the summer or during a drought, or let's say you're coming out of a multi-year drought and all your reserves are low in the service areas, I mean, just the ability to deal with the system has all sorts of economic impacts. And so that is you're dealing with, as well as the conveyance that we're talking about in BDCP is not just for structural purposes, which, you know, you can, there's obviously a lot of debate over the seismic risk and everything else, but the water quality impacts that those levees help guard against, and particularly going forward, as you heard the dreams to, I guess, as Dr. Gilbert said, a potential 10-foot increase in sea level, in essence, flood impacts. You got to guard against that. And then also, which was not mentioned specifically, Mr. Fiorini alluded to the South Delta reverse flow issue, and the report itself points out explicitly the ESA conflict that we're dealing with in terms of management, and that the facility is not just a structural protection, but it's a management tool to increase flexibility within the system for water supply generally. So all that has a lot of benefit to folks. The question I had actually, and one final comment, I did want to also just read one part of the executive summary, and you've heard a little bit about, and we've said this before, we thought the sustainability report did a really good job of sort of laying out, as the peer review said, sort of the economic activity within the Delta and sort of painting a picture of what's there. However, it is, as the, in many respects, an impact analysis. And as the report says, those findings should not be used to evaluate specific futures or alternative options regarding the co-equal goals. That's a different aspect that the plan doesn't really fit into. And I think your discussion also points out comments we've made, and three, I believe, of the six recommendations about really the need to get going on the Delta, the levy issue, the sort of prioritization, the analyzing how we deal with that is something that we really, really promote. My question is for Dr. Gilbert, if he could, is to expand a little bit on, I believe it's the second recommendation, which talks about the cost benefit, this council to do more of a cost benefit of the water supply reliability and Delta ecosystem. I just don't know what that means in the context of the council's role and what the peer review panel is thinking in making that recommendation. It's just sort of a little amorphous, and it's not really explicated much in the plan, in the peer review report itself. So I'm wondering if we get a little more information on that, what that is intended to mean.
Dr. Gilbert, you want to come up and give a shot at that? You don't have to, but if you do. Yeah. Mr. Zlotnick, don't go away. Come back up here.
I think I have a feeling I'm going to get asked about money.
So our recommendation is that the costs are going to be borne by the state, the federal government, as well as the local participants, and that an analysis needs to be done to understand what the costs are to all of these various people and entities and what the benefits mm-hmm. are going to be. So it needs to be a comprehensive analysis, not at the local level and not even just at the state level, because the federal government will likely be a part of this.
Mr. Zlotnick.
I guess the real question, when it because it's just the wording is, I don't have it in front of me, a cost benefit of water supply reliability. Are you talking about within the Delta as part of this conversation of the Delta, the sustainability plan? Or are you talking about kind of statewide, which is sort of what we're all kind of talking about and a lot of this is dealing with in a sort of a 50,000 foot level? But that's kind of the question. Because certain components, as you're aware, in terms of the BDCP, and the conveyance that's part of that, should it go forward, that is going to be paid for by the water users and the mitigation for that, including, as you point out, the economic mitigation. There will be part of that that'll be paid for as just general mitigation with all the, you know, habitat and things that are going on and the loss of some tax revenues. And that's actually in the statute, I believe, that has to be taken care of. So that's on the hook. But when you talk about the water supply reliability and having this council do some sort of analysis of that, what is there more detail or not?
No, I guess, again, the water supply would be not just the water supply coming from the Delta, but it's the water supply for presumably the state of California that we're talking about, and we're talking about the state of California possibly paying to improve the reliability of that water supply and getting the benefits of improving the reliability of that water supply. So it needs to be an analysis that is bigger than the Delta itself, not only in terms of the water supply, but in terms of the impacts to the water supply.
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Zlotnick, let me then just ask you, consistent with our earlier review of the economic sustainability and the levy work, what is the current amount of money the water contractors, federal and state, are prepared to pay for Delta levy improvements and maintenance?
I don't know.
I don't know. Okay.
I know we pay some now. It's not a whole lot, as I understand it directly. But, you know, the contractors, I think, believe, and just like anyone else has said, the beneficiary pays. And as part of a BDCP, the levies are an issue, both from the standpoint of conveyance going forward. We do know that for the interim period, there needs to be work done. And I'm not committing any dollar figures, but certainly I figured we would be at the table to participate in that. The issue then comes down to, and you've heard a lot of the discussion, is which levies, you know, protect quote-unquote state interests, and, you know, the conveyance system is part of a state interest that the contractors are engaged in. What levies, you know, are critical, as you've heard, to if the domino theory holds or not, and how do you deal with that issue? Or are they locally beneficial, and is that appropriate or not? I mean, it's all part of a whole.
Should those
be at the table?
Do your folks support the successful resolution of the details, including cost sharing within BDCP, so that when we get a BDCP plan, we're going to have cost allocations clearly stated?
I am not engaged in BDCP as I used to be as much, so I'm not sure where they are on that. Whether the levies issue is explicit within what they're analyzing. Certainly that's a question as a responsible agency you can ask.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Mr. Koutras for the Five Delta County Coalition. Mr. Koutras.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the council. Being in this hearing room brings back lots of memories, not any good, but memories. I'm always reminded when I come to Sacramento to be polite and to be thoughtful, but I wanted to give some comments with regard to and some advice to the council that we'd like you to take into account when you consider the ESP for inclusion in the Delta Plan, and in particularly in light of the three cabinet secretaries' letter that was delivered. You know, and I'm just going to repeat what you know, that these three cabinet secretaries have a seat on the Delta Protection Commission. Either they or their own personal designee have a seat. I'm outraged that a letter like this comes in after a lengthy process by a commission to adopt a plan. And to have three members of that commission who sit there, who abstained, did not raise any of these objections at the meetings of the Delta Protection Commission, where the public could have heard them raising them, discussed them, the Delta interests who were present at the Delta Protection Commission could have addressed some of the issues from the perspective. As you know, the reform, the 2009 reform legislation did change the makeup of the Delta Protection Commission. It has 11 members who are not state agencies. There are four seats for state agencies. And the statute says that after discussion, it's going to be adopted by a majority vote. And if we're going to respect process and develop trust as we move through the Delta plan and the next 100 years of implementing, I think letters like this coming in give what I would say a different seat than the seat that they've been afforded on the Delta Protection Commission. So I wanted to express that. And frankly, if I were to advise you all, I'd just ask you to throw this letter out.
Well, Mr. Koutras, you know we're not going to do that.
Well,
We don't throw any letters out that come in here. We haven't thrown your letters out that came in after filing deadlines. We're not going to throw out state agency letters.
Mr. Chair, I do believe mine get tossed, but that's my own paranoia. But with regard to the, you're right, you can't toss it out. But I would ask you to give it little weight in your deliberation on the ESP, because frankly, the deliberation on the ESP took place at publicly noticed Delta Protection Commission meetings. You had what I consider a good faith effort to do peer review. You've heard that this morning. You have heard the response that's coming from the consultants and the staff of the DPC that will be heard. I think that's the document that has to have weight in front of you as you deliberate.
Okay.
There's also one last point I wanted to make is that the, and again, in regards to this letter you received, there seems to be a disconnect with regard to the sustainability of the Delta. The statute that says what the ESP has to include is specific, that it has to include local general plans and other local economic efforts, including the recommendation on the continued socioeconomic sustainability of agriculture, its infrastructure, and legacy communities in the Delta. And that is in the Public Resources Code, Section 29759. There seems to be some problem with that in the letter from the cabinet secretaries, where they say that they object to the status quo description with regard to the Delta, and specifically they talk about their concern that somehow that ag is trying to be protected. So again, we've got a conflict in this letter with the statute, and I ask you to hearken to the statute and also to the finalized ESP once it's before you.
Mr. Kuster's, I'd like you to respond to the question I asked Mr. Zlotnick. Now that you've heard anything, what is the proper Delta County's position regarding cost-sharing ratios for improvement in Delta levies?
I think you heard Jeff Michaels describe.
Yes, he was optimistic that reasoned discussion based on
and
facts
I think
could lead to a focused.
And I think that's where we have to be. The Delta counties continually have asked in any decision-making process that they be at the table, that they have a role in that decision-making, and that they participate in that. And we're consistent insofar as the cost-sharing. We have to be participants at that table in that discussion. And I think the process Dr. Michael described certainly is one where we all have to be supportive of and start. Now, Mr. Grindstaff brings up, well, what if everybody doesn't agree? And I think ultimately this legislature will have to make that decision.
I predict to a very high level of certainty that everyone will not agree on how much they should individually pay for much of anything.
Well, and you know, obviously everybody wants somebody else to pay. We've all been there. We all know that. But I think in the end, if there, and here's the key. Is there an agreed-upon plan that, and I'll speak on behalf of the Delta counties, that the Delta counties feel they've been part of the decision-making, that they can support, that they can turn to their local constituents and say, this makes sense, this meets the assurances that we're looking for, and if it does, then citizens, constituents, local jurisdictions, we're going to have to do our part. I think that's going to be the discussion that has to take place. But unless and until we've hit that threshold of, you know, it's not just arguing about the economics, it's are we in agreement of what we're all as a state and the vision we're trying to implement? I think that's the struggle that we're all going to have as this plays through.
Okay.
And tongue in cheek, I hearken back to my formula, 90 cents on the dollar, state and feds, and 10 cents local.
Mr. Kuteris, I remember very clearly
your
formula was 99 cents non-local cost.
I've matured, and I want to show you some movement.
Passage of time
yes.
is now has.
I want to show you some movement on the formula.
That's commendable. Commendable.
Right.
Thank you, Mr.
Kuteris.
Okay. Do we have any other requests to speak on this issue? Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, at 1 o'clock, we're going to start our environmental impact discussion. Mr. Stevens.
Yeah, I might make one suggestion, Mr. Chair, and
we will start...
At 1 o'clock, since it's noticed at that time, and we will go until 4:30.
We will go until 4:30.
So I will be here,
and I will be here.
Fantastic. We will be here. It'll be open until 4:30. You have the option to move agenda items around. On each of our agendas, we have to have a general public comment period, and it
right.
might be wise to dispose of that now if there
are
members
ask
that don't want to go to lunch.
Good point. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak to the council on any subject other than the environmental impact report, which will start at 1 o'clock with a court reporter present? Anyone else on any subject? Seeing no one, the meeting is in recess until 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the Delta Stewardship Council is called back from our brief lunch recess. As a reminder, the public comment period for general comments on the on activities before the council, except for the environmental impact report discussion pending, public comments were solicited and received and there were prior to the recess for lunch. This is file item number 10, members. It is the public hearing to take oral comments on the draft Delta Plan Environmental Impact Report. Mr. Stevens, this is, I think, the second or third time we have had a formal hearing like this with a court reporter present. Perhaps you'd explain again the background, the process, the legal requirements, and so on.
I'd be happy to do that, and you're absolutely right, Mr. Chair. This is the second of our hearings on the draft programmatic environmental impact report that was issued by the council staff on November 4th of 2011. As many people know, we have actually a fairly good website that we would commend people to visit with regard to the information on the draft EIR. We have posted all of the chapters that can be reviewed and downloaded. We also have availability through CDs. We have an opportunity to request hard copies of the draft environmental impact report as well for a nominal price. As I said, the draft EIR was issued on the 4th of November. The comment period is now a 90-day comment period that will end on and includes Thursday, February the 2nd, 2012. At our first hearing, I went over some introductory notes on the nature of this type of hearing, and I'll do that again.
I would appreciate that.
That'd be great. This hearing is an opportunity for the public to present their comments in oral form. They will be transcribed by a court reporter, and those comments will go into the official record of draft environmental impact report. As staff, we will then, as part of the CEQA process, have to respond to comments in what's called a final environmental impact report, which then will be presented to the full council for what's called certification under CEQA. And as I explained before, that's when the council will actually take ownership of the document. We'll be able to figure out whether or not it suits the council's needs as an informative document as it's intended to be under CEQA. And that ultimately will lead to a final decision on adoption of the Delta Plan at the appropriate time. These hearings, as I said, on the draft EIR, for purposes of the council, are in effect listening sessions. They are opportunities for you to hear, if you so choose, and we're heartened to see that we have some council members here to hear the public comment. But it's a listening session for you, and I'd recommend and that you refrain from engaging at this point, because the entire purpose of this EIR hearing, again, is for the public to give the Delta Council staff their comments and suggestions to actually make this document better. You'll hear from several members that have filled out the blue speaker cards, which we would greatly appreciate that people do to help us with our record keeping, to make sure that we accurately characterized who was speaking and what the nature of the comments were. You'll hear from people comments on the environmental assessment that's contained in the environmental impact report. And that I raise that because that's the nature and purpose of this hearing. It really isn't, as you alluded to, Mr. Chair, I think correctly, an opportunity to present general comments on areas within the Delta Stewardship Council's jurisdiction. That's another agenda item that we actually did take care of. The council's always they always are receptive to comments on anything as pursuant to this transparent process, but this environmental impact report hearing is restricted and limited to comments on the environmental assessment in the draft EIR. So with that, I think that when we began this hearing, our executive officer, Joe Grindstaff, talked about a schedule, and I'd like to raise that again.
This is the additional hearing.
Additional hearings. We, as you know, CEQA does not require that we hold these oral testimony opportunities, but the council has directed staff to not only do these two. This will be the second that we've held. But Joe said that we've got five additional hearings scheduled, beginning in January, the first January 11th in San Diego, the second January 12th in Pasadena, the third would be January 17th in Ceres, in Clarksburg, January 18th, and January 19th in Willows. So those, again, will be opportunities for the public to come in, provide oral testimony that will be transcribed by the court reporter, that will go into the official record. All of the comments will be, in one way or another, responded to as part of the final EIR that will be put out by staff and then brought to the council for certification. So with those introductory comments, I turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right, we'll start now with the formal public comment period. I have two requests to speak already, and for anyone in the audience who has not yet done so, if you could please fill out the blue form on a request to speak, and also, for the benefit of our court reporter and the record, if you would print your name in a legible fashion, it would be very much appreciated. The first speaker is Ms. Nikki Sward from Snug Harbor Resorts. Ms. Sward. Why don't you just grab a chair? The corner microphone seems to be working better than the other ones.
Hi, my name is Nikki Seward. Do you need me to spell it? Okay.
Pull the mic.
Okay. N-I-C-K-Y-S-U-A-R-D. And I'm with Snug Harbor Resorts, LLC, on Steamboat Slough in the heart of the Delta. First of all, I want to say I hope you guys have a very peaceful and Merry Christmas or holidays. I know that there's a lot of stress. We're all under it, and I'm pretty sure 2012's going to be an epic year, you know, in a lot of ways. So I hope that you guys have a peaceful time. I am talking about the environmental impact report. But I actually am going to ask for a little bit of engagement, sorry, because I can't really do comments or review because some of the matters in the report right now are a little bit confusing. So I believe that Mr. Grindstaff and Mr. Eisenberg, I know Randy had said that he's flown over Snug Harbor. I've been to a lot of these meetings. I'm sure you know where Steamboat Slough is. So I'm a little bit concerned with environmental impact reports that and the Delta Plan that that mistake the name of waterways. And, for example, in the Delta Plan, as I told you, Mr. Eisenberg, you know, it has a beautiful photo of the Delta, and it says it's Elkhorn Slough, and that's really Steamboat Slough. So how can you do environmental impact reports if you don't know locations? I'm also, and the reason I'm bringing this up is because I realize these can't be innocent mistakes. They have to be intentional. And other examples are in I'm sorry, I don't know which chapter it is, but the chapter on land use and recreation. Hidden Harbor and Snug Harbor are confused, and actually Snug Harbor is described as his Hidden Harbor and named as Hidden Harbor. And so basically, does that mean the state is erasing Hidden Harbor or erasing Snug Harbor or both? It, you know, it's a little bit confusing. So how can anybody assess the impact to our own businesses and our own lives and our own properties if the state doesn't even know we exist, even when somebody's as vocal as I've been? So I wanted to ask why. You know, it can't be innocent mistake. It's got to be intentional. This has happened too many times.
Mr. Stevens.
Yeah, I'd be happy to engage to the extent that this nature, the nature of this forum allows for, Nikki. And I know that you've come as a vocal advocate for various causes. And I think speaking on behalf of the chair and the other members, they appreciate it. With regard to the nature and purpose of this oral comment period, your comments with regard to whether or not there's inaccuracies are entirely appropriate. And in fact, they're going to be taken down by the court reporter to the extent that you can be as specific as you can, whether or not it's here right now, and or followed up by a written comment that points out chapters, pages, whether or not you think something's intentional, unintentional, or whether or not it doesn't matter in your opinion is entirely up to you. And I think that, you know, again, that'll be a comment that we will take a look at as staff. If we got something wrong, if there were inaccuracies, then it'll be reflected in a final environmental impact report. But again, the nature of the document right now, as I described, is a draft that was prepared by staff with the help of consultants. And the purpose of this comment period is to hear from you as to what we got wrong. I don't think it's appropriate to engage on whether or not something was intentional, unintentional, whether there's a conspiracy. If it's inaccurate, please point it out to us and we'll take a look at it.
I do plan to submit written comments, but you know, I thought that it would be appropriate to have it be recognized that despite, you know, comments by different people in the Delta, not just myself, the consultants or whoever's writing these documents are persisting in providing false information to the public. And that is inappropriate. Okay, and you know, you're the one who uses the word conspiracy. That's I don't believe in that kind of stuff, okay? What I'm just saying is that it was intentional. So, it's so obvious if you track it. And I have been tracking the maps and the documents over time. And it's a very clear and intentional mistake, I guess you could say. And yes, I will be making comments. And it will have to do with how the state is revising, calculating flows. And I'm going to be talking about how DREAMS report that I do appreciate that the state took the time to correct the incorrect data in DREAMS report, but it's really frustrating to see that time and again, the current documents are referring back to the original raw data and the original DREAMS report from 2008 when the corrections were made in December 2009, and many of the consultants doing their reports don't even realize that. And so I think the state needs to be more aggressive in letting consultants know, because the state is going to be, the state, meaning me and you, the taxpayers, are going to be responsible for the costs of litigation when false data is used to validate the Delta plan. So I got to fix that before that happens. And then the other issue I will address is you know, the proposals to limit development. That's condemnation. That's eminent domain. That's taking away people's property rights. And you really have to question for what environmental purposes. That I haven't seen that yet, but those will be my comments. Thank you, and I do hope you have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Ms. Ward. The next speaker who submitted a blue form is Mr. Neesmith from the California Environmental Water Caucus. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is David Nesmith, N-E-S as in Smith, M-I-T-H. I'm the co-facilitator for the California Environmental Water Caucus. We will be presenting significantly detailed comments in written form, but I just wanted to flag a couple of things for you all to consider. It's mainly focused on the California Water Solutions Now alternative, which was to our great delight reflected in one alternative that was dedicated to those solutions that we have been suggesting in a report that we wrote a couple of years ago. A couple of just clarifying comments and a suggestion in terms of our alternative. On the ocean desal, we will be providing more detailed comments written, but basically there's three things that we are concerned about here. Many of the currently proposed coastal desal plants are proposed for to be co-located with coastal power plants. And most, if not all, of those coastal power plants have once-through cooling, which is a cooling method which has now been identified as highly problematic and by state regulation is being considered to be phased out. If desal were to be considered, it should be very clear that it should not be extending the life of old power plants, cooling systems, intakes that are once through cooling power plants. These are huge destroyers of marine life, and we have actually changed that regulation in the state. And so the desal must not be. We must have some language in there to make sure that that does not extend the life of that. So no ocean open ocean intakes. There are very well developed technologies for beach wells and other indirect methods of taking ocean water in. Obviously, there are many other sources of water for a reverse osmosis or a desalination process, brine water, municipal wastewater, and we consider these to be much more appropriate in many cases. And we would also like to see desal, ocean or otherwise, be located in a way that would be powered in a way that was using renewable power, because they are a fairly large user of power. We would like the ecosystem restoration portion of the Water Solutions Now alternative to reflect the more detailed ecosystem restoration language, which is in the proposed alternative, because we didn't go into great detail, but we agree with the proposed alternative's details as far as ecosystem restoration. So we were a little less specific, but we like the specificity reflected in the proposed alternative. As far as flood control, We actually do have language in our response to comments in the previous drafts of the plan that is not are not reflected in the environmental documentation that we do support reducing flood risk, and we have recommended immediate planning to begin immediate planning to upgrade levees to beyond the PL 88.9 level. So we want to see that flood control planning initiated as soon as possible, and you all could be an important advocate for that. And finally, as far as water supply, I note that we have the state and federal water contractors in the audience, and I know they will not agree with me on this, but the California Water Solutions Now has identified many actions that could be taken statewide that would reduce reliance on and demands for increased or current levels of supply from the Delta. We think that both ag and urban water efficiencies have been identified. There is adequate evidence on the record from several organizations, state and reputable non-governmental organizations, talking about water efficiency possibilities. And we believe that a reduction in water supply from the Delta could be reduced to a less than significant level, and that that should be reflected in the Water Caucus, the Water Solutions Now alternative, that there are these alternatives, conservation, reclamation, stormwater reuse, in capture, and so forth, that are detailed. And that concludes my comments. Thanks for your good work. And
thank you, sir.
I'm very impressed by your very short lunch. It's no wonder you're a slim man.
Okay. Ladies, do we have any more blue slips? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak on the draft environmental impact report? Anyone in the audience who would like to speak? All right. This here, I'm sorry, sir. Come on forward.
I haven't filled out my form. Should I do that?
Why don't you sit at the chair, fill out your form so we'll make sure we spell your name correctly, and then you can make your comments. We'll loan you a pen here. There we go. All right.
It's like an exam here, excuse me.
And if anyone else in the audience has not yet done so but wishes to speak, there are blue forms, what is it, Pat, outside? And up here in front, so you could fill them out in advance.
Sorry about this. Who do I give it to?
To the young lady right there. Yes, sir.
William Brooks.
Mr. Brook, please take a seat. Of course. If you give it to our staff, we will. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I have three questions concerning this. Why is the pollution to the environmental? Why is the pollution to the environment caused by the new power stations that will have to be constructed to power this single water conveyance system not mentioned in the environmental impact report? The current biggest user of electricity in the state is the state aqueduct, pumping water to us, to Southern California, over 3,000 feet to Hatchapeese. This is over 2,200 kilowatt hours per acre foot of water. The plans for the new proposed project indicate a total pump capacity five times the current value. That's the equivalent of two new power stations and five times the current pollution, which is of significant concern to most Californians, I'd say. The EPA currently states the following concerning coal, petroleum, and gas power plants, which make up 40% of California's energy producers. The scrubbers at power plants are the nation's biggest producer of toxic waste in water. These include dissolved aluminum, all the things on the list you're seeing there. They have shown to contribute to cancer, organ failures, and other diseases, according to the state documents. The EPA also states that air emissions from these power stations cause nitrogen, sulfur dioxide, and particulate matter. Again, I see no mention of carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, hydrocarbons, nitrogen oxide, sulfur oxide, anywhere in this environmental report. Furthermore, what about the extraction of gas? The 300-plus carcinogenic chemicals from gas fracking industry are already polluting the groundwater in the Delta. Yet there is no mention of this in an environmental report. It seems crazy. You'd think that something like this should at least get a mention. That's why I've handed you that form there. My second question is, my understanding is that these pumps pump five times the current aqueduct water capacity, and they have the capacity of actually draining the Sacramento River in the summertime. Think of that. Where is the mention of the impact on this on the environment? And finally, how can the removal of so much water possibly protect, restore, and enhance the Delta ecosystem and the environment? Please, someone explain this to me. I think that all Californians have a right to water, and I support necessary sustainable power production. But how about an environmental report looking at the spending of the same taxpayers' money on some other alternatives, such as giving every Southern Californian a free dual-flush toilet and every farmer a free drip feed system, and spend the rest of this money on water conservation projects, efficiency, stormwater capture, grey water treatment and landscaping, low-flow fixtures, water assessment help, and the subsequent jobs this could create. It could save the same amount of water and cost the taxpayers much less in the long term. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Brooks has also submitted to us a one-page printed paper, and our staff will give a copy to the court reporter for her records. The title of the document is Requested Addition Inclusion in the Environmental Impact Report, carrying today's date, December 15th, 2011. And Mr. Brooks, I believe those are your initials, WRB, behind it. Okay, the record will reflect the submission of that document. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak on the draft environmental impact report? All right, ladies and gentlemen, as we did at our first meeting, we have, and Mr. Stevens pointed out this morning, we have noticed this hearing to last until 4:30 today. We will, since there is not currently a person wishing to speak, we are essentially going to recess in place, where I or any other council member will be here the entire time. And the minute somebody wants to talk to us, we will reopen the hearing. We will activate the court reporter and our electronic simulcast on that. And I believe we are going to post a notice on the simulcast board that you folks have worked out, and perhaps you might put it up there right now so we can take a look at it. That would be helpful. He's looking for it right now. Okay. It cannot be the baseball scores that you put up one other time. Okay, it's going to take a minute to find that. All right, it is now 1:27 according to my clock, so we will go in recess, recess in place right here. The staff and council member, at least a single council member, maybe more, will be here during this time. So any of you who want to speak during this time period, be sure to notify one of us of that fact. Give us a few minutes to get everybody back in place and the simulcast running, and we're off. So in a temporary recess, members, staff, thank you very much.
Just to make sure you're here.
There you go.
Here you go.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Delta Stewardship Council is, as you know, in recess. On the other hand, we have, and to explain, we have been here since 1 o'clock, the scheduled time for our environmental impact report comment period. We received certain reports and comments from individuals at that time and went into recess upon hearing that nobody else in the audience wished to testify. However, we have noticed this hearing process to close adjourn at 4:30, and accordingly, this is an announcement that we will go back into recess, but we will remain here till 4:30 to hear and receive comments. Mr. Stevens, anything else that need be added?
No, sir.
Okay. So, with that notice and those notations, let us go back into recess, and if our technicians would post again the previous notice, we would appreciate that. Audio. Is called back into session. It is now 28 minutes after 4 on Thursday, the 15th of December. Our meeting is slated to adjourn in 2 minutes, and now 90 seconds, and we will, before that time, or at that time, ask if there are any people in the audience who wish to speak to us on the draft environmental impact report. And again, for the record, the court reporter, staff, myself, counsel have been present. Other council members were present during times of this hearing when we have been in recess. And at least as of this time, no individuals have come forward during that entire time period and indicated they wish to address the council on the environmental impact report. Thirty seconds more to go. Okay, 4:30 has arrived. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to address the council on the environmental impact report? Seeing no one appearing who wishes to do so, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Maybe, huh? Yeah. It's just going to be to sit here.
That's the thing. That's probably, that's why it was.
She sat here the whole time.
Yeah, she did. Either she's getting painted the hair, or she's really interested to see if you guys are going to not follow the rules.
Or she didn't want to go back to work.
Or she didn't want to go back to work. She acted like it was going on all night.
Just in case there was a
Just